This is Audible.
Cthulhu Armageddon, written by C.T. Phipps, narrated by Jeffrey Kafer. Chapter 1. The sun blasted against our environment-reinforced uniforms. We were moving through the Great Barrier Desert, a massive tainted zone larger than the new Arkham Dust Zone by several orders of magnitude. Our dust masks and goggles kept the worst of the radioactive sand away, but not all. I was leading Gamma Squadron Rangers and carried a T-17 heavy assault rifle in my hands. We were on foot, having left our jeeps to recharge their solar batteries. All of us were carrying more equipment than usual, looking like a collection of walking arsenals. Recon and extermination missions were usually the most dangerous, and we were equipped accordingly. But there was something about this mission which made us double stock on weaponry. Strangely, the thing I was most aware of was the weathered Stetson on top of my head and the leather duster around my back. That was my single most cherished possession, a legacy from my father. He'd been a member of Gamma Squadron before me, and I'd requested the right to wear his hat. It was stupidly romantic of me, but I sometimes felt his ghost was looking out for us. I felt it was the least he could do after trying to murder me as a child. "Look alive, Gammas," I spoke into the microphone hidden in my mask. "We should be spotting this black cathedral any time now." I remembered our mission now. It was an errand of mercy. We were performing a rogue operation the Council of Leaders never would have approved of. We were just supposed to scout the area, find out the local tribes' numbers and armaments, but one of their chiefs had persuaded us to look into a series of mass kidnappings. Our team wasn't at full strength, only the six of us remaining from our original 8-man squadron, but the remnant had neglected to reinforce us. We'd just have to make do. I'd exceeded our orders by taking us on this investigation, but there had been children involved. Children always change things. They were the one universally precious thing to all of humanity. Whoever was taking slaves from the local villages wanted especially young captives. That was enough to melt even the hardest soldier's heart. Well, almost. "I still don't know why we're looking into a bunch of illiterate savages having their brats stolen," Joseph Stevens said behind me. A blonde-haired and blue-eyed man's man, Stevens seemed to think he was a purer example of humanity than other members of the squadron, ludicrous as that may be. "If we manage to get them back, they'll probably eat them. Then they'll try and eat us." "You're doing this because I ordered you to," I said in response. In fact, that wasn't strictly true. I'd asked for volunteers, and Stevens was the only one to object. "You're a heartless bastard, Stevens," Jessica said, speaking in a smooth southern drawl. She was a pretty brown-haired girl underneath her mask and armor, something which many individuals had noticed on our treks across the wasteland. It was fruitless, though. Jessica wasn't interested in a relationship. She might gently flirt, but she'd lost her husband only a year ago during the color incident. I felt more than a little guilt for the fact I hadn't been able to pull him out of it alive. There was also what had happened to her children. Frankly, I didn't understand how she continued to function, much less joke around. "It does not require a majority to prevail, but rather an irate, tireless minority keen to set brush fires in people's minds," Jeremiah Jimmy Schmidt said, quoting some figure from Old Earth's past. Jimmy was the most educated of us, despite being the youngest. I was a distant second, understanding roughly half of the references he made. Occasionally, he'd catch flack from Stevens for his African descent. It was one of the reasons why I'd made a number of requests for the latter's reassignment, not the least because I was every bit as black as Jimmy. "This whole cathedral is probably just a hoax. Don't you think we would have noticed a huge stone temple sticking out in the middle of the desert?" Stevens was clearly more nervous than he was letting on. Part of that had to be his own superstitious fear of the wasteland. I was of the mind that Stevens was more ignorant than actively malicious, but his manner had always grated on me. Still, he was a part of my squadron, and that meant he was closer than anyone but family. "The wastelands can hide a lot of things," Jessica said, her voice hanging in the wind. "My grandmother once saw a dragon in the wastelands."
"Your grandmother didn't see no goddamn dragon," Stephen said. "There's no such thing."
"Have you ever seen a dragon?" Jessica asked.
"No," Stephen snapped back. I just said that's impossible. Then you can't say they don't exist.
Jessica stuck out her tongue, a childish gesture, but one that made me chuckle.
That makes no...
Stevens trailed off as he bumped into my back. Spread out before us was a particularly deep valley in the sands. In the center of the dusty wastes was a cathedral. Not just a temple or an old church, but a genuine honest-to-God cathedral with soaring towers and architecture like the kind humanity hadn't been able to build since before the Rising. The building stood alone, no surrounding infrastructure or community. It was a testament to its builders' dedication and resourcefulness. They'd been able to construct something like it in the middle of nowhere. Yet I couldn't admire them too much because the building was disturbing in a way no piece of old Earth architecture could match. On a very primal level, looking at the alien building made me sick. The color of the building was black, darker than obsidian, with stone seemingly formed from the very night itself. Grotesque statues lined the outside of its walls. The obscene statuary included both great old ones and mutated humans, each more hideous than the last. Its cyclopean walls were covered with stained glass windows made of some twisted organic crystal. The building itself seemed as much grown as constructed in some places. Every time I blinked, the building seemed slightly different, as though my eyes weren't able to fully grasp its entirety. A disgusting black biomass was growing out of the ground and wrapping itself around the building's towers.
What the fuck is that?
Stephen said, summarizing the entire unit's opinion.
Who the hell builds a cathedral in the middle of the fucking desert?
Jessica asked, staring. I hadn't realized until now she hadn't thought the name was literal.
Mormons? Jimmy suggested.
Very funny, Jessica muttered.
I don't think they've changed that much since my great-grandpappy's day.
I would have guessed the cathedral to be extra-biological entities, EBEs in construction, possibly mutant or alien in origin, if not for the familiarity of the place. Despite how sickened I was to look at the place, I felt a definite sense of déjà vu as I stared upon it. Parts of the building were less inhuman than others, resembling the most ancient of human structures. Yet its alien components dwarfed those familiar constructions, as if all I could recognize was a pale shadow of what this building's mad architect had achieved. The black cathedral was magnificent. It was abominable. I can tell you what it is. I loaded up another magazine. It's our target.
Are you sure you want to continue, Captain?
Sergeant Misha Parker asked. Parker was a pale-skinned woman, with half of her face having been badly damaged by acid, but with still functioning sight. Parker was new to the group, but someone I still trusted. She was a survivor of Alpha Squadron, and came highly recommended from that now-defunct group. Still, I hated when she questioned my orders.
Yes, Parker, I'm sure.
I'm ready, sir. We're all ready.
Private Thomas Garcia added, reminding me we were understaffed with only 6 soldiers. Garcia was a thin but tall man, with glasses and a shaved head. He was openly gay, though received no flack from Stevens over it. I suspected that was because they were cousins.
Speak for yourself, Garcia, Jessica said. This is weird even by our standards.
Jimmy walked up beside me, pulling out a pair of binoculars to get a closer look.
Parts of it look ancient Egyptian and other parts early Byzantine Empire. There are definitely influences of both Maya and medieval European architecture as well.
A lot more of the influences I can't place, though, nor would I want to. For example, the semi-organic motif.
Thank you, Jimmy. I glared at him.
You're welcome, sir.
That was completely useless. I rolled my eyes. Jimmy grimaced.
Yes, sir.
I understood what he was saying, though. The place looked simultaneously influenced by seemingly every culture on Earth, but being none of them. Despite the fact it couldn't have existed before the Rising, it almost seemed to predate humanity. There was a primordial feel to the place. I felt in my bones this building had seen the rise of humanity and would exist well past our extinction. That was impossible, though. Nothing like this had ever been constructed by pre-Rising mankind, especially not in the middle of the Great Barrier Desert. Taking out my binoculars, I did a quick survey of the terrain. I don't see any guards or sentries, but this place is huge, larger than some old Earth skyscrapers. If the slavers are inside this, there could be hundreds of them.
They're likely to be packing a lot less, Captain.
Jessica adjusted her cowboy hat, a relic similar to mine she wore with my blessing.
She gave her heavy assault rifle a humorous slap, as if it were a gun from the Old West. Drawing from her courage, Jimmy and Stevens exchanged glances before nodding.
"We should go in," Jimmy said. "This could be a threat to New Arkham and the United States Remnant."
The Remnant consisted of New Arkham and some outlying villages, so saying both was traditional but redundant. I smiled, proud of Gamma's dedication.
"Very well. I suggest we go in quietly and see what we can see."
"Are you sure we shouldn't radio headquarters? The General should know about this,"
Parker said, looking nervous.
I took back what I'd said about their dedication.
"Kinda defeats the point of a secret mission, doesn't it?"
Steven said, giving her a sideways look. Parker looked down at the ground.
"Just shut up and keep a lookout," I said, feeling strangely drawn to the place.
Even more than rescuing the children we'd been sent to find, who were most likely dead, I wanted to go inside. There was a terrible energy bubbling beneath the surface of the Black Cathedral's walls, an energy which, despite how insane it was, felt familiar. Walking forward, my team traveled through the Black Cathedral's broad open doors, and we encountered no hostiles. The insides were no less surreal than the exterior I'd earlier remembered seeing. It was a place bizarre in both subtle and grandiose ways. The doors, for example, were octagonal rather than square, while the columns holding up the domed ceiling above our heads were made of an organic stone-like coral. The chamber around us was illuminated by a mixture of diffused sunlight streaming in through bulbous windows and free-floating orbs of green crystal. I'd never seen anything like it in my 2 decades of exploring the wasteland.
"Fascinating," I could hear Jimmy say behind me.
"Yeah, if you like funhouses," Steven said.
"I wonder if this is a building belonging to the mythical pre-human elder things or Yithians,"
Jimmy said. "It's possible that some force, perhaps tremors from the rising or deliberate human effort, forced this place up from the underworld where it was buried."
"Jimmy, I love you, but maybe you should stay focused," Jessica said. "We're hunting slavers."
"Sorry," Jimmy said, looking uncomfortable as he checked his heavy assault rifle. "I guess I've just always wanted to meet a genuinely intelligent EBE, not the usual psychopathic killers we meet."
"You already know Richard," I said, leaning down to examine the smooth gray stone floor. There were signs of recent passage, human, too, by the size and shape of the scuff marks.
"May I say how uncomfortable I am with the fact that the captain knows a ghoul and hasn't shot him yet?"
Steven said, raising a hand.
"Yes," I said, "you may.
And if you ever tell anyone about Richard, I'd like to register your remaining life will be measured in minutes,"
Jessica said, her eyes boring into Steven's. "He's helped us a lot."
"Be quiet, all of you. It's not natural that no one has come out to meet us. Even if the slavers aren't based here, there should be some sign from the inhabitants. The best case scenario is they're hiding. The worst..." I didn't need to say the rest.
"Order, sir?"
Jessica's voice became very soft. "We move in quietly," I said, also lowering my tone. "Nice and quiet. No engaging of targets unless I say so. Our first objective is to establish if the missing children are here. If they are, getting them out becomes our top priority. Stick to the shadows and corners. Avoid any and all places where ambushes seem likely. It's possible the slaver saw us coming and moved farther into the temple, so we need to be cautious. Any questions?"
"No, sir,"
they all said. "Good," I said, waving them forward. Moving deeper into the Black Cathedral, I was immediately struck by how much the place reminded me of a museum. The rooms we passed through were filled with treasures from across the world, most of it pre-apocalyptic. It must have taken the owner years to loot enough historical sites and vaults to fill this place. As we proceeded farther towards the center, the treasures were gradually replaced by displays of historical sites and battles, which grew darker and more perverse with each room visited. The first ones were merely chronicles of humanity's wars, but the final ones showed humanity's slaughter by the Great Old Ones.
"Permission to make a comment, sir?"
Jessica said to me, hefting her heavy assault rifle before her.
"Granted,"
I said, trying to hide my disgust.
"The man who owns this place is seriously fucked up,"
Jessica said.
I had to agree, looking up. There, hanging like we were in some sort of medieval castle, were a set of green and gold banners with the elder sign in a circle.
The sideways pentagram and I inside it filled me with a strange sense of unease.
"Take a look at what's hanging over our heads," I said,
Strange to see cultists using that.
Damned cultists, Stevens grunted. It's them who brought the great old ones.
We are pilgrims in an evil land, Jimmy said. This is a lot more civilized than your typical set of wasteland savages, Parker said, looking around. I mean, who collects antiques after the end of the world?
Maybe someone who was around before it, Garcia said.
Cut the chatter, we've got a job to do, I said.
I was feeling uneasy beyond belief. There was a sense of danger in the air.
It only grew worse as we reached the central dome of the Black Cathedral, the place where we'd achieve access to the entire building. The place was almost completely empty, not a soul in sight, which screamed trap. Nevertheless, as if supernaturally pulled in a certain direction, we proceeded into the center of the room, ignoring my earlier advice as if all military discipline couldn't hold us back from taking in the sights around us. The walls depicted a freshly painted mural of particular insanity, showing in blasphemous glory the fall of mankind to the great old ones. It was just one of the hundreds of things on display, as the room had artifacts of the various EBE species spread throughout the acre-sized chamber. The centerpiece of the room, however, dwarfed them all. There, one of humanity's greatest foes had been put on display as a trophy. In the heart of the room, propped up like a skeletal Tyrannosaurus Rex, was a collection of bones unlike any other I'd ever seen. Topped with a fish's skull, it was the shape of a man, but at least 20 feet tall. An aura of power encircled it, even as it was propped up with wires from the ceiling. At the foot of the great beast was a display stand covered in a little gold plaque reading, "Here lies Dagon, least of the great old ones." Stephen shook his head. Seriously, the guy who runs this place is utterly batshit.
The wasteland has driven most of humanity's survivors mad, I muttered. It's why we exist, to protect the remnant from the rest of them. Honestly, given how the Council reacted to encountering other groups of survivors, I wasn't sure we were all that much better. Several small nations had emerged on the East Coast, and the Council was determined to pretend they didn't exist or treat them as hostiles. I'd killed almost as many humans as EBEs during my 2 decades of service. Jessica looked at the statue of Dagon with something approaching awe.
Do you think it's really one of the great old ones?
If it was one of the great old ones, he wouldn't have been able to kill it, I said coldly, still unnerved by the sight. It looks like nothing more than a particularly large deep one. Chicanery, nothing more.
Chica, what now? Stevens asked.
It means trickery. Jimmy rolled his eyes. Seriously, Stevens, you could use a couple more years in re-education.
I've got other ways to amuse myself, Stevens chuckled, giving a lewd look towards Jessica and Parker. If you know what I mean.
You could never keep up with me, Stevens, Jessica said, surveying the landscape for possible points of entry.
Stevens looked between me and Jimmy.
I'm just kidding. You girls are like sisters to me.
That says more about your family than I ever desired to know, Jessica said, snorting. And we're women, Stevens. Learn to tell the difference, and maybe your dating life will improve.
Parker smiled at that.
So did I.
It was weird how casual everyone was being in a potential combat zone. That was when I realized what was going on. Someone was asserting a psychic influence over us, forcing us to relax. Martha had tried it during a few arguments over the years, only managing to piss me off more whenever she did it.
Everyone shake it off, I said, trying to warn everyone. It's too quiet for this not to be an ambush.
You just had to say it's too quiet, didn't you?
Jessica grunted.
Sorry. That was when 12 secret doors opened, and 100 armed Cthulhu cultists poured out.
Chapter 2. The Cthulhu cultists were a motley band of half-deranged psychotics, but Earth had never seen more fearless warriors. Armed with meat cleavers, baseball bats, makeshift spears, and whatever firearms they'd scavenged, the cultists were more of a mob than an army. Their clothing and armor were as eclectic as their weapons, consisting primarily of scavenged sports equipment and bits of scrap metal sewn together. There were no tactics or strategy to their assault, only sheer numbers driven by mindless ferocity. I had heard legends the cults of Cthulhu used a combination of drugs and ecstatic rituals to drive all fear of death from their warriors. Seeing the way they whooped, hallowed, and rushed eagerly into the jaws of death,
I believed it.
Humans forever!
Stephen shouted one of the traditional battle cries of the R&D Rangers, cutting down several cultists with his heavy assault rifle as we sought cover. Overturning museum cases and knocking down the statue of Dagon, we brought the full force of our weapons to bear. The first part of the battle, if you could call it a battle, was little more than a slaughter. No matter how brave a warrior, how skilled, he was nothing more than a target for even a moderately skilled soldier armed with automatic weapons. We did not indiscriminately fire into their ranks, but selected our targets. It was a slight delay, one many commanders wouldn't have encouraged their troopers to make, but one I drilled my team for often. This method, nicknamed crowd control by Stevens, guaranteed a kill every time. It slowed down the enemy's charge and filled the room with corpses. The tide of Cthulhu cultists managed to use weight of numbers to their advantage, however, getting close enough to engage us in hand-to-hand combat. Despite their reckless courage, this too failed them. Each of my team was more than a match for any five of the barbarians surrounding us. The trick was only engaging that many at a time, an increasing prospect as they came after us in ever greater numbers.
For the glory of Great Cthulhu!
One tomahawk-wielding, punk-haired lunatic shouted, wearing an amulet which caused bullets to bounce right off of him like raindrops. He managed to charge right up to Jessica and swing at her head. She promptly clocked him across the face with the butt of her gun, before shooting him on the ground and returning to fire into the crowd. I was impressed.
"These guys are idiots!"
Parker shouted so everyone could hear her over all the automatic gunfire. Jessica pulled close to cover me.
"How you handling yourself, Captain?"
"I've been better," I shouted, cutting down more of the enemy combatants trying to swarm us. When one got close enough to stab me, I smashed his face in with the butt of my gun and shot him with the last rounds of my magazine. Reloading, I brought to bear my weapon to mow down an additional five charging me.
"Fair enough,"
Jessica laughed before slamming her machete's edge square into one of the cultists' head before blasting another in the chest. Some might have called it psychotic glee, but I called it excellent soldiery. In the wasteland, you had to train your men to enjoy combat, to love it, in order to survive. I often wondered whether it was the right thing to do, but it was too late to change anything now. I, too, had been trained to get a thrill from battle. Parker and Garcia covered each other, and the two of them made sure none of the Cthulhu cultists got anywhere near as close as the one Jessica had to take down. Their style of fighting was different than the others, as they focused on three-round bursts. Stevens and Jimmy fought side by side, the two ignoring their usual belligerence to concentrate on the enemy. By the end of five bloody minutes, both men had saved each other's life a dozen times. Our caution in bringing so much equipment proved well justified, as the extra ammunition proved the difference between life and death. Corpses were strewn across the ground by the dozens, some of them having fallen in piles as the horde kept coming over their own dead. The battle was wearing, but tired and exhausted as we might be, we emerged victorious in that particular struggle. Not a single Cthulhu cultist chose to flee, but we'd annihilated them nevertheless, all without a single casualty. Even by Ranger standards, it had been a tremendous victory.
"Well, that was anticlimactic," Jimmy said, kicking a cultist's corpse. "They just ran to their deaths."
"Another triumph for New Arkham, freedom and superior firepower," Stephen said, giving his rifle a kiss.
"Do you think it's over?"
Jessica stared across the battlefield, looking at the corpses of well over 100 slavers littering the ground. She visibly winced at the battle damage done to several of the display cases, the artifacts inside having been destroyed by gunfire or grenades.
"No," I said under my breath. "No, I don't."
The assault by the Cthulhu cultists had been too crude for the mastermind we were investigating. He or she had plotted the removal of hundreds of children from dozens of settlements. His or her minions had done so in an efficient, methodical, and thoroughly well-planned manner. This, by contrast, was the work of someone with no thought whatsoever to strategy. "Even if we've destroyed the bulk of their fighting force, several hundred children were reported missing. They have to be here somewhere," I said, looking around the room. The place had been devastated by our battle, symbolized by Dagon's bones being scattered about like so much refuse. "It's our duty as members of the United States Remnant to secure their release."
"Yeah, assuming any of the kids are still alive, these crazy psychos probably ate them," Stevens muttered, rubbing the back of his head. Despite his words, I could sense the worry in his voice. Stevens wasn't a sociopath, and his disdainful treatment of our mission was a way of divorcing himself from the probable fate of those we sought to rescue. At least that was what I believed. I had faith in him, despite our disagreements.
Don't even joke about that, Stevens.
Jessica looked at him with a disgusted expression on her face. Stevens, in fact, was not looking at her. Instead, he was staring at a pile of corpses nearby.
Damn, some of those bastards are still alive.
That's very unlikely,
Jimmy started to say, before turning his head to the bodies. Then I saw his head tilt in confusion. Following his gaze, I saw the corpses he was looking at were starting to move. All of them were starting to move.
Shit!
Parker said, stepping away from them and pointing her gun down at the corpses around her.
God damn it! West boys! Shoot him in the head!
Stephen shouted, aiming at the various corpses' skulls and unloading with ammunition. For once, I believe Stevens had the right idea.
Everyone, we've got reanimated class undead. I want you all to fall back into a circle with covering fire on their remains. Aim for either the head or the spine.
Yes, sir!
My squadron shouted in unison, spraying the rising monsters with bullets. I just prayed it was enough. The reanimated, known as West Boys and Ranger lingo, were the single most deadly type of undead to emerge in the aftermath of the Rising. I had high enough clearance to know they were an evil the Remnant had brought down on itself. While I was too young to have participated in the fall of New Boston, I knew it had been the Remnant's experiments which had resulted in the reanimated becoming a self-propagating plague on humanity. The Herbert West formula created durable, semi-intelligent, and fearless creatures without any sense of morality or restraint. I'd never fought them before, but my grandfather had told me they were several times stronger than the ordinary zombies created by wasteland sorcerers. There was no telling how the lunatic in charge of the Black Cathedral had gotten a hold of it.
Captain, do we have enough ammunition to kill them all again?
Jessica asked, continuing to fire in short bursts.
No, I said solemnly. We don't.
All around us, the bodies of the Cthulhu cultists began to slowly pick themselves up and retrieve their weapons. Those who had been damaged in their legs moved slowly and awkwardly, but the majority moved faster than they did alive. The fact they seemed to ignore gunfire anywhere but the most vital portions of their body made them nearly unstoppable, though. We managed to shoot a number of them in the skull and spine before they rose, but there were at least 60 to 80 in front of us by the time we prepared for our exit. Worse, the reanimated were between us and the entrance, leaving us effectively pinned down.
Switch to flamer rounds,
I called. We had only one magazine of flamer rounds each, so it was mostly a choice of when we were going to use it than if. However, fire might give us a short reprieve.
You got it!
Jessica shouted, firing the bullets that caused the bodies of several charging reanimated to catch fire. Jimmy and Steven soon joined in, the flaming corpses coming at us until they collapsed from the nerve damage. The reanimated, who possessed some limited intelligence, seemed to back away from the fire, even if only for a few moments. That bought us valuable seconds as I considered my options.
How many grenades do we have left?
I asked, firing another spray of bullets into the skulls of a half-dozen reanimated. Their bodies collapsed and caught fire as the undead behind them fell back, only to eventually move around them with ruthless determination. Jimmy and Jessica responded to my question by hurling a pair of grenades into their ranks. The resulting explosion was neither large nor spectacular, but it blew several of our opponents to pieces and thinned their ranks enough to give us a little breathing room. Only a little, since the reanimated were infinitely more dangerous foes than the cultists they'd been but minutes earlier.
Those were the last of them, Captain,
Jessica said, right before she was bitten on the arm.
Son of a bitch!
Parker shot the monster before the injury was anything more than a surface wound, Jessica smacking it across the chin with her rifle butt.
Does that mean she's gonna turn?
Stephen shouted, knocking another reanimated away with the butt of his rifle, before setting it aflame with the explosive ammunition in his gun. Kicking the flaming corpse away from him, Stevens created a protective barrier in front of him. He was surprisingly cunning when he remembered to use his brain.
No, Stevens,
I said as we found ourselves pressed against the back of the central chamber. That was when I noticed a grand staircase was now behind us, a huge marble thing decorated with hanging chandeliers which had simply not been there before. Taking a look at it, I shouted over the blare of gunfire.
Well, that doesn't look like a trap, does it?
What do we do, Captain?
Jessica said, shooting a few of the reanimated in the legs to slow down the ones behind them. It wouldn't work in the long run, but was the only option we had in such tight quarters. With only a few flamer rounds left between us, the reanimated were going to overwhelm us within moments. I didn't have a chance to respond before the reanimated corpse of the bullet-immune cultist charged at Parker and then bit into her throat, tearing it out. Parker didn't get a chance to scream before blood sprayed, and she went down. I pulled out a machete my wife had blessed, then charged forward, cutting the corpse's head clean off before ripping away the amulet. The creature fell over in an instant and ceased to move before I tossed away the amulet and jogged back into formation, shooting the entire way.
Jesus!
Garcia said right before a reanimated on the ground grabbed his leg and pulled him to the floor. It crawled up on him and gouged out both his eyes with its thumbs, tearing away his face with its teeth. Jessica managed to shoot it, as did Stevens, but it was a futile gesture since a half dozen more reanimated were already upon Garcia, tearing him apart. There was nothing that could be done for him, and he had to be abandoned if we were going to survive.
Up the staircase,
I ordered, sick to my stomach at our losses. We'll switch to pistols once we reach the top and try to take them out one by one.
Murderers!
Stevens cried out, tossing his heavy assault rifle on the ground. The last of his flamer ammunition was expended. He then pulled out a refurbished Desert Eagle and started shooting reanimated after reanimated in the head. This was a mission of revenge now for my teammate, and I worried I'd lost him. Jimmy was slower getting his pistol, instead getting overwhelmed by a horde of the creatures when his assault rifle ammunition ran out. Stevens didn't hesitate to throw himself into close-quarters combat with Jimmy's attackers, firing the gun into their faces at point-blank range.
No, Stevens! Fall back!
I cried out, lifting up my own pistol as I watched Jimmy crawl out from under the mass of reanimated dead. What happened next was blood-curdling. Stevens was ripped limb from limb as the monsters chopped away at his arms before pulling him to pieces.
Son of a bitch!
Jimmy coughed, bleeding from the mouth as he crawled on the ground, pulling his own gun out to shoot a few avenging rounds at the individuals murdering his squadmate.
I said fall back!
I repeated my order. I snapped the neck of a reanimated coming within inches of me and fired a few shots into the heads of the ones between Jimmy and me. I'd not lost any squadmates since the color incident, and it was painful to experience it again. Private Stevens hadn't been my favorite trooper, but he'd willingly lay down his life for Jimmy. It made me ashamed I'd ever doubted him. Everyone finally moved back into formation as we were given breathing room by the burning corpses before us. The fire we'd set, plus all the reanimated we'd shot in the spines, slowed down the 30 or 40 undead remaining to give us time to get up the staircase. We'd inflicted massive casualties on them, but at a terrible price. I was first up the stairs, almost to the top, with Jessica behind me. Jimmy trailed behind us, possibly wounded. A number of reanimated broke through the fiery barrier and charged up at him. Refusing to leave a man behind, I lifted my pistol up and descended the stairs, shooting one after the other in the head. Five were down as Jimmy passed me. I, for a second, thought we were going to make it. That was when a lone reanimated assassin at the bottom of the staircase, a woman missing the lower portion of her jaw, lifted a revolver and fired over my head three times. I didn't even see her until it was too late. Clicking off a final round, I sent her spiraling down to the ground where she joined the ranks of her other forever dead colleagues.
Captain!
Jessica cried out. Turning around, I saw Jimmy had been hit by all three rounds in the back of his head. Both of his eyes had been shot through, and so had the back of his mouth.
Damn it!
I spit, knowing we didn't have time to mourn our losses. I'd gotten my entire team killed, but forced that thought from my head. I needed to survive and get my sole remaining teammate to safety. I didn't care if I got killed at this point, but I had to cling to the idea I could salvage one of my brethren.
Jessica, keep moving up the stairs. We've got to get a move on.
I didn't have time to say more because black tendrils descended on us both, throwing us to the ground and sinking into our skin like leeches before lifting us into the air. I was able to catch a brief glimpse of their source at the top of the stairs, a figure standing in front of the gigantic blob-like thing producing the tendrils. It was a white-haired man with skin the color of chalk, dressed in a dirty suit left over from centuries past. I recognized him as Alan Ward, my old teacher and one of the last human scientists left on the planet. What the hell was he doing here? I didn't have time to think about it before I passed out. Chapter 3. The first thing I saw when I woke up was a blinding bright light. My mouth was full of saliva, and I had a splitting headache. Attempting to move, I found my wrists and feet were tied to the back of a chair.
Hello?
A soft female voice spoke in my ear.
Are you comfortable?
I hated it when captors were polite. The memory of my team's death was fresh in my mind, and I was tempted to bite at the throat of whoever was holding me. I was still too weak and in shock to respond with anything but the mildest rebuke, though.
Fuck off. You can go to hell for all you've done.
I'm lucky I don't believe in hell. You're not a prisoner, though, John, at least not of mine. You're also not in enemy hands.
What?
I blinked, wishing I could see what was going on.
Where am I? Where's Dr. Ward?
Dr. Ward hasn't been part of the Remnant for decades.
I spit the saliva out of my mouth on the ground and tried to get my bearings.
I'm confused. I don't know where I am or how I got here.
Obviously.
The light moved away from my face, revealing I was in one of the Remnant's hospitals. Most certainly not the Black Cathedral. I also wasn't wearing the uniform I'd been wearing when I'd been struck by Dr. Ward's magic. That briefly filled me with a sense of relief. Then I realized the person holding me was one of the most infamous interrogators in the Remnant, and the attire I was wearing was a gray prison jumpsuit.
Damn it.
So much for not being a prisoner. Rather than focus on my circumstances, I instead looked over my captor. If not for who she was, it wouldn't have been an unpleasant sight to look on. Mercury Takahashi was a 30-something crimson-haired woman wearing a dirt-smudged laboratory coat, slacks, and an old but serviceable green shirt, which highlighted a pleasant-looking body. Thin like most of us, but not emaciated, Mercury's almond-shaped eyes, dimples, and soft cheekbones made her quite pretty. Supposedly, that only made her more effective at her job.
"Do you remember who I am?"
the woman asked, almost sweetly.
"Yes,"
I answered her.
"Do you know who you are?"
Mercury blinked, trying to read my reactions. It was a strange question. I knew exactly who I was and didn't understand why I shouldn't.
"Captain John Henry Booth, United States Remnant Recon and Extermination Ranger, Gamma Squadron Leader."
A number of other useless details filled my head, like my address and where I'd gone to school. It was like my mind was fact-checking itself. I must have taken a bad blow to the head. I couldn't even remember how I'd gotten here. It was as if there was this terrible blackness in the back of my skull, and I couldn't face it.
"Correction, John, you were a captain," Mercury interrupted. "You were stripped of your rank 3 days ago. It's 5/27/2137.
A month later.
Jesus.
"No," I stared at her, blinking.
"That's not possible."
"You've been found guilty of murder and treason. As for your squadron, you killed them."
"I... Jessica, too?"
"So you don't deny it?"
"The Black Cathedral killed most of them, but... Alan Ward."
"So you mentioned. The former director of Arcane Studies is the one who killed your squad?"
I nodded, glad she understood.
"Yes, he's built some kind of cult in the middle of a temple in the Great Barrier Desert. Actually, it's more like an army that can come back from the dead."
"You mentioned him in your sleep, but the council wasn't interested in excuses."
Mercury almost sounded conciliatory.
The horrible fragmented images continued to intrude on my conscious mind, driving out all else.
I saw shambling mounds of rotting flesh, desiccated husks, and vile caricatures of human beings, the kind of creatures people made up legends to explain. The reality was worse than any horror story could begin to convey. I formed my memories together and recalled the reanimated and our tragic encounter with them, but in the end couldn't remember what happened next. There were gaps in my memory.
"God Almighty,"
I whispered, wishing I could clutch my head in horror. The bindings prevented me from doing so, holding me fast despite my struggles against them.
"I'd be careful about calling on gods. You never know what sort of being will answer,"
Mercury said, walking to a nearby cabinet. She pulled out a syringe and a clear, fluid-filled vial. Mercury proceeded to fill the syringe in her hand with the vial's contents and walked over to inject it into my arm. "This should help you relax. How badly were you injured out there?"
"I don't know," I said, my mouth dry.
The room wasn't very clean. The tile walls were stained a sickly yellow color, the floors looked like blood was routinely spilled on them, and the paint on the cabinets was peeling. Much of the scientific equipment was old, dating back to the pre-rising period. The rest had been constructed from materials dating back to that time. Worst of all, there was a rotting fish smell to the place, possibly from the experiments they conducted here on EBEs. A horrible sinking sensation filled my chest, wondering whether my loved ones were suffering for this insane accusation.
"My family. What about them?"
"Your wife's been reassigned to another spouse, and your children repurposed to other families." Mercury had an almost reassuring smile. "They'll be fine."
I wondered if she was trying to emotionally claw out my guts, or she was just that insensitive. "Thank you."
"Stay focused," Mercury said, dismissing my concerns with a cavalier wave. "Do you remember what happened on your last mission?"
"Some," I said, sighing. "Not enough. I'm not guilty of killing my squadron, though."
"I know, John. No one thinks you did. You were a respected war leader, and tragedies happen on the battle."
"Then why?"
"Politics," Mercury said, taking her equipment back to where she'd retrieved it. "No one wants to admit responsibility for losing another squadron, and your survival would make you a hero or a villain. They chose villain lest you threaten their power base."
It was pathetic. The Council of Leaders was playing games over who got to control one dying city on a dying world. "What about my wife? Did she go along with this? Did she try and fight this?"
Mercury spared me a look of sympathy. "Martha Booth was the first to denounce you. Her transcripts are rather colorful."
I closed my eyes, trying not to cry, and just barely succeeded. I'd saved my tears for my squad. "I see. When am I to be executed?"
"You've already been executed." Mercury walked over to a nearby desk and pulled out some extra-large black-and-white photos. Taking the pictures in my tightly bound hands, I looked them over. I was startled by a grisly series of images depicting my trial and execution. The pictures ended in my funeral and cremation. No one attended my funeral but security, an ignominious end for an otherwise exemplary career. She'd clearly gone to elaborate lengths to get me here.
"What is this? Who made these?"
Everything was taking on the surreal quality of a nightmare. Just when I thought I couldn't be surprised by this terrible world, it seemed the universe was determined to provide a new and more insane display of why everything was chaos and disorder. "I paid your guards off in food rations. They probably think I'm going to perform some sort of ghastly experiment on you."
"Are you?"
I was strangely calm about all this.
"Of course not."
Mercury leaned down and whispered in my ear, her voice gaining a sultry edge to it. "Though I did let it slip, I was considering using you for recreational purposes."
I raised an eyebrow.
The staggering tastelessness on display here made me wonder if she had some form of mental infirmity.
"Excuse me?"
Mercury put a hand on the side of her hip, posing for me. "My assigned husband was 70 when I married him. I bet you would be far more entertaining."
"I do not bed murderers."
I remembered the horrible time I'd been a prisoner of the Dunwich.
"Not willingly."
Mercury straightened her posture, frowning. "It'll be a wonder if you'll ever breed again then, especially where we're going."
"You've lost me."
I stared down at my clothes. I would have to get a replacement scent if I was going to get out of here. Already my mind was working on ways of figuring out a plan of escape. "How familiar are you with the wasteland?" Mercury asked me bluntly.
"Very. I'm the best scout we have." Was the best scout they had.
"That's not what I asked."
"I know the wasteland. I know it well."
I answered her again, growing irritated.
"I could survive in them indefinitely."
"What about people?" she asked, her tone a little more desperate. "Are there any people outside of the remnant?" Her ignorance was quaint, really, though I wanted answers. My patience was rapidly drying up.
"There are many groups of humans outside of the remnant."
"Are they tainted?" Mercury's lips actually quivered.
Cannibals? Rapist?
I wondered what kind of story she'd been hearing. There are tainted cannibals and rapists among them. The majority, however, are simply people. Now what is this about?
Mercury took a deep breath.
I want you to take me to what passes for civilization.
I stared at her like she was mad.
I'm not in the mood for jokes, Doctor.
Mercury clenched her fists.
This is no joke. I need to escape New Arkham and the Remnant. It is no longer safe for me here. I need your help to do it.
You're the Council's scourge. I shook my head. Why would they want to get rid of you?
No, I was their scourge. Something has happened which will change that very soon.
Mercury took a deep breath. I can't go through what I've done to other people.
I had no sympathy. It is the one comfort of this cold, vast, and unloving universe that it is equally as uncomfortable and horrifying to the terrible as it is to the good. You have earned whatever is done to you.
No one earns anything. There are survivors and the dead in this world, nothing more.
Mercury raised her hand again, as if she was going to slap me.
Don't you want to live, John?
I was still processing the fact Gamma Squadron was dead. Parker, Garcia, Stevens, and Jimmy, all killed by the living dead. I'd had a responsibility to bring them home safely so they could help one of the last pockets of humanity survive, and I'd gotten them all killed on a fool's errand for a wasteland tribe. I deserved to die, but I needed to get back to the Black Cathedral. I needed to avenge them. Call me Booth. We're not on a first-name basis. Knowing my family would be safer here than out in the wasteland, I made a decision. What do I get if I help you to civilization?
Saving your life isn't enough? Mercury asked, looking exasperated.
From you? No, I said calmly. I have other concerns than life now. I'd taken my job in the R&E Rangers as a form of protracted suicide, really. Everyone who went out into the wasteland made peace with death. Life in New Arkham wasn't a guarantee. At any point, our ramshackle civilization could be exterminated by the horrors beyond, but it was more likely to keep you alive than being among those who scouted the surrounding territories. No, I wasn't afraid of dying here, only of leaving my brothers and sisters unavenged. A human hand had killed them. Ward. A man, not a monster. Something which could be killed.
You're impossible, Mercury sighed, looking defeated. I need this.
I was surprised by her display of weakness, half wondering if it was an attempt to emotionally manipulate me. What sort of life did she really think could be found outside in the wastelands, anyway? It was a rough, brutal, and unforgiving sort of existence, especially for a woman. Make it worth my while.
Mercury took a deep breath and stared, her voice cracking. I'll get you guns, ammunition, and a jeep. Is that enough?
Her desperation surprised me. How many people said that to you before you killed them?
I was chosen for this job, Booth. If I hadn't done it, I would have been shot. What would you have done?
I remembered shooting a fellow trainee for stealing food during basic. Suddenly, I didn't feel so righteous. Fine, I'll see you across the desert, past the dust zone, away from the mutants, through Ghoul Pass and up through the shadow of the Great Idols. I'll take you to Kingsport, which is as close to an actual city as probably exists outside of the Remnant's control.
Thank you. Hopefully I can find a position there.
Yes, I sighed. You're medically trained, aren't you?
I was going to be a physician before they assigned me to research and interrogation,
Mercury said, hopefully. Then you won't have to be a prostitute or a slave, I said, harsher than necessary. I didn't want to help her. After this we're done, I never want to see you again. You won't want to be around me anyway. I intend to continue to fulfill my duty after my escape.
Your duty?
The disbelief in Mercury's voice was palpable.
What duty?
Blood and vengeance. It was one of the few things left which humanity could purely call its own. Chapter 4. Getting out of Mercury's laboratory wasn't difficult. The sun had set over the horizon, and I was used to moving in the shadows. In my gray prison fatigues, I was practically invisible against the similarly colored buildings of the Remnant. There was also the fact that the remnant soldiery was used to watching for people trying to break into the city as opposed to the reverse. Still, I'd need a good look at just who was doing what if we were to get out of this place. Once out, I dodged guards and citizens alike until I made my way to the set of cliffs jutting out from the center of New Arkham. The tiny mountains were an after-effect of the rising. Whole sections of the globe had been casually upended by the great old ones, ancient cities unearthed from the ground or recreated, as human civilizations were erased with the casual ease of scattering a child's building blocks. Reaching the top of the peak wasn't difficult, and I'd scaled it dozens of times. Taking a series of deep breaths, I took a moment to survey my former home. The runways of the former United States Air Force Base were covered in hastily constructed bunkers and adobe-esque huts. Its useless traffic control tower served as homes for rich families. Lights were on all across the makeshift community, television antennas sticking out of the roofs of houses. A series of worn electric fences surrounded New Arkham, each guarded by heavily defended checkpoints. Each layer of the perimeter had its own scrap metal watchtowers, gunnery emplacements, and landmines to supplement security. In other words, escape would be difficult. A familiar voice spoke behind me, almost causing me to fall over the cliff's edge. I knew you would come up here. It was always your particular form of madness to look down at the human race from above, as though you were one of the gods rather than an ant. Somehow my wife had managed to make it up the side of the cliff without me being alerted to her presence. Even for a psychic, that was impressive. Martha, I said, turning around. I didn't expect to see you up here. Why, because you're supposed to be dead or because I testified against you? Martha asked. Both. I see, Martha said. Martha Ann Booth walked easily up the rocky pathway, one I'd only barely managed to navigate. The shadows parted, and I got a good look at the woman I'd been married to since I was 17. Martha was touched by the great old ones, but her inhuman traits fell onto the realm of the exotic as opposed to the macabre. Her skin was the color of marble and her hair a shade of silver. Her almond-shaped eyes were her most striking feature, resembling the predatory yellow ovals of a cat. Tonight she was dressed in the black trench coat of a loyalty officer, an outfit which reminded me, however much I might have once felt for her, her loyalty was foremost to the Council of Leaders. I looked away from her, shaking my head. How did you find me? I have my ways. She was a psychic. Stupid question. Right. Tell me, do you see a future for these people? Martha asked, gesturing down to the city below. It was an odd question, given what was going on. No. Did you ever? No. Yet you keep fighting for them. Why? I shrugged. Why not? Easier to die. That was an odd way to deflect a conversation. That's not in my nature. This is the great old one's world now. Perhaps it always was, but that doesn't mean I'm going to roll over and let them take from me what little part I've carved for myself. Honestly, I doubt they even noticed us when they woke. Earth's governments used nuclear weapons in the first hour of the rising, but they were like raindrops against the great old one's skin. Martha then switched subjects. Tell me, what's your next move? Are you going to try and steal away your children? Perhaps ask me to run away with you as well, treason aside? No, I said, thinking about how I'd been a terrible father who'd missed most of their childhood. I want to be with them badly, but the wasteland is no place for children, even teenagers. The remnant is a decaying shell of itself, but it's still the safest place in the world for a boy and girl. And us? Martha asked. That ended a long time ago. True, Martha said, her cat-like eyes almost luminescent in the night. I was asking for your sake. I shook my head, annoyed with her attitude. Then again, she was a psychic, and they rarely were ones for conversation. Can you at least tell Anita and Gabe I'm not a traitor? Do not worry, I do not intend for them to grow up believing lies about their father. Though, technically, by all accounts, you are a traitor. You hate everything the remnant stands for. I'm surprised you made it as far up the ranks as you did. I ignored her jab, mostly because it was true. Why did you do it, Martha? You could have kept silent. They wouldn't dare go against you. The loyalty division practically worships you. Martha stared at me in a way which was almost threatening. I was well over 6 feet tall, and she was only midway past 5, making her glare almost comical. Yet looking into those mutant eyes, I felt like she might push me over the side of the cliff with her gaze alone.
John, you wandered in from the wastelands naked and covered in dried blood. You were babbling in tongues no one recognized, and had apparently walked 200 clicks in a dust storm. No normal man could have survived that.
I blinked at her description, surprised by the new details it brought to my ordeal.
I wandered in naked?
Strange how that was the part which bothered me.
Yes, Martha turned to me. Even if you had explained the truth of what happened, they would have condemned you. I could no more protect you than I could myself if I rose to your defense. Something supernatural happened out there, and the tiniest whiff of it is terrifying to the Council.
All right. Martha wasn't done, however. Everyone in the Council believes you to be a monster in human guise. Something out there happened to you, something which changed you. Most of the Council believes you to be no longer human. Those who think you are believe you to be incompetent, a man who got his entire squadron killed.
I tried again to remember just what exactly had occurred, to no avail.
I can't tell you what happened on my squadron's last mission. It's mostly a blank. All I know is Alan Ward was involved somehow. He killed them.
Consider yourself blessed you cannot remember the details.
Martha walked over to press a gloved finger against my chest.
Memory loss can often protect us against what the human mind is not equipped to handle. As for Alan Ward, I suggest you drop it. He was the most dangerous man ever produced by the Remnant. He was more of the old ones in the end than human.
No, I said, my voice lowering. I'm going to kill him. Slowly, painfully, like a human.
Your squad mates are beyond caring, and your own peace of mind would not be helped, I'm sure.
Martha's gaze softened, and she actually looked concerned, her yellow eyes glowing in the night.
Simply assume the Black Soldier took pity on you and guided you back home. It would be better for everyone.
The Black Soldier was a wasteland scare legend, one my father had passed down to me from his father, and so on, since the days of the old world battlefields where it had originated. The Black Soldier wandered the battlefields of the world, granting curses and blessings. Some days I believed in him.
I can't do that, I said, staring down at the ground.
All right, I'd say good luck, but there's no such thing anymore. I stared out past the city into the desert. The dust zone surrounding the Remnant stretched on endlessly, lifeless silver particles having replaced whatever had existed before the Rising. There were people beyond the dust zone, people who were every bit as deserving of the Remnant's protection as the citizens below me.
Thanks. I have something for you.
A photograph of the children? I asked, half joking. Film was too rare to waste on such things. It had been an extravagance to use it for my execution.
One last kiss?
Martha paused as if the idea hadn't even occurred to her.
I suppose those would have been appropriately sentimental, but no. My gifts are a bit more practical.
Pity. Reaching into her jacket pocket, Martha removed two objects. The first was a curved golden blade about the size of a Bowie knife. Carved into the sides of its surface were sigils that seemed to twist and turn as if alive. It was a deep one rune blade, a creation of ancient Relayan magic and considered taboo by civilized Remnant citizens. I'd seen only a few in my time, and they could carve the flesh of EBEs like cheese. I looked to the second object. It was a little black leather book, roughly the size of the Bible. I doubted it was a copy of that book, however, as my wife was an avowed pagan. There were also numerous handwritten notes and what looked like a couple of folded maps inside. The book smelled of cinnamon and dust, yet there was a strange weight to it, as if the paper's very contents were somehow making it heavier.
Thank you.
I reluctantly took both objects. Due to its weight, I took the blade to be made of actual gold. A piece of gold to melt down and trade, as well as a book to read on the way to Kingsport. Both should come in handy.
You will find this book more valuable than gold or iron in the wasteland.
Martha leaned up to kiss me on the cheek. Her lips were warm, the only part of her that wasn't cold as ice.
It is the only one of its kind left here in the Remnant. Study it well, and if you remain sane, it might save your life. Indeed, it might if you don't.
Checking the insides, I saw there were numerous illustrations of indescribable entities and non-Euclidean geometric diagrams. It also contained numerous unintelligible scribblings with translations underneath. I recognized a few as ceremonial languages of the people who had emerged from humanity's scattered bands of survivors, but the majority of the material was foreign to me. A copy of the Necronomicon, Martha said, as if that explained everything. It holds secrets lost to even the learned. I see. A lovely parting gift if you were a psychopath or a madman. I had no idea what sort of use I'd get out of a grimoire of pagan sorcery. Yet it was quite possible Martha was right. Wastelanders put stock in such things, and using their own superstitions against them could mean the difference between life and death. I imagine your companion will also find its writings interesting. Martha said the word companion like she was cursing. Her reaction surprised me. I'd long thought her uninterested in my dealings with other women. The fact I had no such interest in Dr. Takahashi made it all the more ironic. You'd have thought she'd know better since she was capable of reading minds. Martha, I... My hesitant speech didn't last long. An inhuman screech cut through the quiet of the night, the sound loud enough to shatter glass. What the... I shouted, grabbing hold of my ears as I stared into the sky. There I saw a terrible shape streaking out from the stars, a vision straight from an abyss worse than hell. Descending upon us was a faceless, man-sized beast. Tall and scarecrow-like, it possessed a long black barbed tail and thin membranous wings that stretched out into the night. Its chest was covered with some kind of thick armored exoskeleton, one which should have prevented it from flying in any rational world. Unfortunately, we were living in anything but a rational world.
Out of the way!
I shouted at the top of my lungs, ignoring all secrecy as I bodily carried my way from harm. Rolling across the cliff face's surface, I heard the beast behind me land with a sickening crunch. Despite its size, its claws tore through the stone like wet tissue paper. The being had no expressions to read, but I could feel its hostility, the almost incomprehensible aggression radiating from it. Staring at its faceless form, I struggled to keep my gaze steady. The entity seemed to occupy space in an impossible manner, as if it was larger and more vast than the thing I saw. I couldn't really describe the sensation, like a two-dimensional being trying to perceive something with three or four. A mere glance was enough to make me feel sick to my stomach. Whatever it was, this creature did not belong in our reality.
A night gaunt, my wife whispered. Death has come for us.
I can see that. I scrambled for some sort of weapon on the ground, a rock, if nothing else. The book she'd given me lay a few feet from us, covered in dirt. My wife picked up the golden blade I dropped and handed it to me.
Take this, John. It can hurt it.
A grenade would have been better, I muttered, taking the knife in my hands. Down below, I heard alarms going off across New Arkham. The creature's cry had probably been heard halfway through the city. Ignoring the effect it would have on my escape, I moved into a combat position, holding the heavy knife across my chest in a close-quarters fighting stance. The beast didn't move for a second, keeping an almost wary pose. It was uncharacteristic behavior for a wasteland predator. They almost uniformly treated human beings as only a little more threatening than mice.
"Move, you bastard!"
I said through gritted teeth, hearing another terrifying cry tear through the air before the monster jumped at me. Despite its size, it moved more like a cheetah than a man, yet I was already prepared for its attack. I let the force of its body push the knife up into its frame while I let it knock me down the side of the mountainous path I'd climbed. The creature's cries were ear-piercing, threatening to deafen me as I felt a thick acidic ichor dribble down onto my hands from where I'd stabbed it. The pain was intense, almost as if my hands were on fire, yet it only inflamed my desire to kill the creature. Raising my legs and requiring every bit of strength in them, I pushed the creature off me. The monster weighed more than it appeared. The creature howled once more, slid across the stone, and stretched out its wings, readying itself to pounce. I didn't give it time to move, though, instead suicidally raising my knife to stab the abomination repeatedly across its torso. The golden blade sliced through the creature's armored exoskeleton as easily as the monster's claws had carved through rock. I slashed over and over, causing the creature's twisted and blackish organs to spill out onto the ground. The monster did not die easily, however, jabbing its talons through my left shoulder as I continued my attack. Driving the knife into its faceless skull, I felt weak as I heard Martha speak.
John, you need to stop. You're bleeding to death.
Shit. Chapter 5. I stared at the gaping wound in my shoulder. The night gaunt's claws had torn into the skin and muscle beneath. I was bleeding out over the dead abomination's crumpled form. I'd been lucky to take it down with me. Humans were inherently fragile creatures compared to even the weakest of the great old ones' servitors. Killing the beast was little consolation, however. My quest for vengeance was over before it had even begun. Martha was at my side, her voice filled with surprising concern.
This wasn't supposed to happen.
I doubt the Night Gaunt took that into account. I began coughing, gasping for air. Falling on the ground, I saw my blood start to pool around me. It was a disgusting but familiar sight to me, as I'd seen many soldiers die of injuries far less severe than the one I now had. In a futile gesture, Martha tried to stem the tide with her hands.
I'm sorry.
They say your life flashes before you just before you die. I wasn't sure if that was true, but I could feel the barriers in my mind falling apart as the lifeblood freely flowed out of my body. In an instant, I was no longer there on the mountaintops overlooking New Arkham. I was once more with my squadron on our final mission. Perhaps it was God's, or whatever was out there's way, of compensating for the fact I was about to die. My vision started to break up. A shifting torrent of new imagery filled my mind's eye. My pistol emptying its last round into Jimmy's decaying undead form, the biomass throughout the cathedral coming after me, 1,000 tooth-filled mouths, and a wounded Jessica fleeing out of the door as I desperately held my flamethrower in front of me.
Ah!
I cried out before launching myself upward, waking from my delirium with a staggering pain in my shoulder. Despite the agony, I was struck by a single fact. Jessica was alive. I couldn't believe it. Then slowly I realized it was true. She'd gotten out of it. I didn't fail them all. Even more so, I knew what had killed Jimmy and Stevens was in this so-called Black Cathedral. I had to get back there, mortal wound or not. I needed to find the bastards who'd kill them every bit as much as I needed to find Jessica and bring her home.
John!
I heard Martha's voice shout in my ear.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I blinked, shaking off my vision. Oddly, it didn't feel like I was dying. I'd been wounded before, and the sensations that accompanied it were lacking. There was no pain, no feeling of shock, and I honestly felt better than I had in years. Both Mercury and Martha were beside me, the noise of the base's alarm still blaring in the background. The two women were staring at me like I'd just risen from the dead. Glancing over at the wound on my shoulder, I wasn't sure I blamed them. They'd removed my shirt, so I got a good look at the damage done to me, or to be precise, the lack of damage. My wound had completely healed over, a white handprint in place of the gaping hole which had previously been there. It was as if God or an angel had reached down and pulled me up from death. I had to reach over and touch the wound to be sure it was real.
"What are you?"
Mercury said, her voice filled with a kind of horrified awe. My wife spoke, too quickly for my comfort.
I used my powers to heal him.
You used your powers? Mercury stared at her in awe before it turned to anger.
You're lying. If you had that power, it would have been known about by now.
We all have our secrets, Martha responded before turning back to me.
How are you feeling?
Where my hands had once been calloused and worn from years of work, they were now crisscrossed with albino white scars from where the creature's acidic blood had burned me. Yet before my eyes, the scars were fading and the flesh returning to its original black color. The handprint on my shoulder was also disappearing, becoming only a scarred outline. Fine, I continued to stare. I feel fine. Was the council right? Was I a monster? Had my father been right all along? No, fuck him. Damn him forever. I was better at being a soldier, being human, than he ever was. He was not right. Martha snapped me out of my fugue with her next words.
The base has been alerted by now. It won't take them long to realize something happened up here. We need to get going.
It sounded like she was trying to get rid of me. I was surprised to find the creature was already gone. The monster had melted away like a bad dream, and no trace remained, save the gory ichor on my knife.
I see your point, Martha. Mercury, do you have our transportation?
Mercury blinked as if suddenly realizing she was being talked to.
Oh, yes, I have your jeep, a Mark 7 light carrier. It's just a few yards down the path. I also requisitioned enough supplies to get us to Kingsport, I think.
Good. Standing up, I lifted up my arm and gestured for her to go ahead. I'll meet you there in a moment.
Mercury nodded.
Turning around, she jogged toward the nearby jeep. Somehow she'd managed to get the thing up the narrow path along the cliffs. I could barely make its shape out past the bright glare of the headlights. The Mark 7s were nothing more than glorified composite vehicles made from the parts of non-functioning pre-rising automobiles, but they were serviceable enough. I could make out a number of old transportation barrels sitting on the cargo bed. Hopefully, with a little work, we could make the back into a decent smuggling compartment. Turning back to my wife, I said, "You summoned that thing, didn't you?" I don't know how, but I knew it to be true. Her guilty expression confirmed my suspicion. Even without magic, some psychics had the power to control EBEs. Martha was one of them. She could bring them across the desert or conjure them from thin air. It wasn't an ability the Council of Leaders allowed her to use often, especially since summoning them was different from controlling them. She could, but only with great difficulty.
I'm sorry.
Martha took a deep breath and exhaled. The Night Gaunt proved stronger than I expected. I held the golden knife underneath her neck, tempted to slit her throat then and there. You betrayed me once and I was willing to forgive you. I'd be a fool to do it again.
Yes, you would be.
Martha's voice became low and almost resigned.
You're too soft for the wastelands, John. You know nothing of the true forces which rule the earth.
I know enough, I hissed at her, wondering why she thought taunting me was a good idea at this juncture. Did she really think I wouldn't harm her? Damn it, of course she did. She was psychic.
No, you don't. The curtain you've pulled back opens to a world where rationality has no place. A world where the old rules of morality and physics are just synonyms for delusion. The fact that creature broke free of my control was unexpected, but so is the fact you killed it. You've survived wounds no normal human being could have. Something happened to you in the wastelands, something that has made you different from other humans.
I should kill you for just babbling all that nonsense. It wasn't nonsense, of course. I understood what she was saying. I just didn't know how it applied.
Then do so.
Martha's voice was calm, precise, and ordered. You're important to the world, more important than me. I can't quite divine the reason, but you will buy the human race a few more years before its extinction. However, I sense great troubles in your future. I had to see if you were ready for them.
So you sent a monster to kill me?
I grunted, unable to believe what I was thinking. I still kept the knife at her throat despite knowing I couldn't harm her.
Bitch.
Yes, Martha whispered. I could hear her voice finally crack, the first hints of genuine shame and guilt now audible in her tone.
I did, and I am.
Knowing I was incapable of harming her, I lowered the blade.
You gave two lives to this world with me. I'm sparing you for their sake. Don't make me do it again.
It was an empty threat. We both knew it. Martha stared at her shoes, shaking her head almost sadly.
That tender heart of yours is going to get you killed.
Probably. I sighed. Putting the gold knife away in my pocket, I put the book she'd given me in the other one. I started to walk to Mercury's jeep. Just bursting out of the front gates would be suicide, so we'd have to use stealth. A plan was beginning to form in my head when Martha called from behind.
You called a woman's name, Jessica, in your delirium. Is she your lover?
I paused in mid-step.
No, I care for her, but our relationship wasn't like that.
Do you love her? Martha asked, her voice a mixture of curiosity and jealous. I loved all my squadron.
Not what I meant.
Not that way.
Then I hope you find her.
I could hear the reluctance in her voice.
And I hope she's still human.
Me too. As I started down the path down the mountain, Martha said,
John, don't forget the Necronomicon.
I turned back to her and stared at her. I'm not going to need a book out there.
You will,
Martha said, sighing.
more than you could possibly imagine. I'm going to call in the troops to look to the residential areas for that creature and divert their attention, but you need to know some things before you depart.
I don't need lessons on how to survive the wasteland.
You do about Alan Ward.
I narrowed my eyes. What do you know?
Ward had been my teacher, my friend, even before his banishment. I had considered a career in science before diverting to the military after his exile. Martha, however, had been one of his pet projects. It had been because of Alan Ward's influence she and the other touched were employed by the Remnant, rather than killed as in the olden days. Alan Ward believed, as you do, that the human race would never reclaim the planet Earth from the great old ones, that we were doomed to die out on a world which was increasingly no longer ours. He, however, believed it did not have to be that way.
Then he was a fool.
Was he? Martha asked. Dr. Ward believed it was possible to make humanity as the old ones did, free and wild and beyond good and evil, with laws and morals thrown aside and all men shouting and killing and reveling in joy. Then the liberated old ones would teach them new ways to shout and kill and revel and enjoy themselves, and all the earth would flame with a holocaust of ecstasy and freedom.
I looked out to the wasteland beyond. I think we're already there.
He wanted to change us, John, to use the blood of deep ones, ghouls, and other creatures, combined with the science we've learned from Yithians to make us a new humanity, one which was as immortal as the other species and capable of surviving the new earth. He learned the sorcery of the Dreamlands and spells of that book in your hands to help make it happen.
What happened?
They exiled him for it, obviously. They destroyed his research and kept only those like myself who were too useful to discard.
I walked up to her. All the more reason to track him down and put a bullet in his head.
Martha looked at me. Actually, I'm arguing that you may be the product of his research. If he's continued, then maybe there is hope for our species.
It was a disgusting accusation, one which was worth killing a man over, whether in the wasteland or in New Arkham. All humanity had left to cling to was an inflated sense of genetic purity. My ancestors had no trace of monster running through their veins, and the accusation of such thrown at my mother was enough to get my father to kill her before trying to kill me. Martha knew how hurtful such an accusation would be to me, but she'd thrown it in my face anyway. Harlot. Witch. Abomination. I stared at her, opened my mouth, closed my right fist, then looked away. I don't think we're gonna see each other again. I walked away. Then I heard her chuckle.
Never say never, John.
Chapter 6. The entire base was on high alert, the sound of klaxon horns audible across the city. Guards were probably combing the city up and down for the night gaunt. It was justifiable concern, but couldn't have come at a worse time. Eventually, no matter how good I was at hiding, they'd find me. Our only option was to escape now, and I'd hastily laid out a simple, but time-honored plan to get us out of the city. I was lying in the back of Mercury's Jeep underneath a makeshift false bottom. Above that was a collection of waste barrels carrying food and water amongst other supplies. It wasn't elaborate camouflage, but there was elegance and simplicity. Focusing my attention on our escape allowed me to put the incident with Martha behind me, at least for the time being.
Let's just hope the guards are as corrupt and inefficient as I remember back when I was a grunt, I muttered and sucked in my breath as we pulled to a stop. Everything would depend on Mercury's ability to talk herself past the gate. If worse came to worst, we could probably make a break for it by shooting our way past the perimeter guards, but I didn't relish the prospect. These soldiers were my family, after all. Still, it was possible we could find our way out if that became necessary. Beside me in the smuggling compartment was a small arsenal. There was a heavy assault rifle, grenades, pistols, and plenty of ammunition. Mercury had done extremely well in arming us for our journey. I gave her that much. I stopped strategizing when I heard a guard speak, signaling the most important part of our escape had begun.
Hello, Dr. Takahashi. What are you doing out here?
I'm transporting hazardous biological waste out of the base, Mercury said, responding with a smooth confidence.
What? The guard asked in disgust. You're kidding.
I never kid about my work. It contains EBE corpses and human testing remains.
Mercury maintained her chipper attitude, probably unnerving the men further.
You know, the usual.
Dr. Takahashi, the base is on alert. There's a possible EBE incursion. We can't let you out when we're still searching for it. It'd be too risky. The guard had adopted an almost flattering tone, probably hoping to kiss up to someone close to the Council of Leaders. Apparently, whatever was driving her to flee from the Remnant wasn't common knowledge yet. Mercury didn't miss a beat, reacting as if it was just another night at the office. That's why I'm moving the barrels outside of the base. It's possible the creature is being attracted by biohazardous material scent. I'm going to observe whether or not they attempt to follow the trail I'm leaving. As lives went, it seemed pretty safe. After all, what did the average soldier know of the habits of EBE hunts? I barely knew anything, and I had clocked more combat time with them than anyone. Ma'am, we're going to have to inspect these barrels. I could hear the disgust in the guardsman's voice. That's certainly your prerogative. Have you had all your shots? Mercury had that same pleasant tone to her voice she'd used when speaking to me. It was the kind of tenor which had probably broken a dozen or more hardened soldiers during interrogation. Shots? I could hear the bewilderment in the guardsman's voice. Vaccinations against mutation and contamination when handling hazardous materials, of course. Mercury said, sounding almost bored. You don't want to be touching this stuff unless you've had them. Not unless you want a couple of extra fingers or eyes. Ugh, just go, the guardsman said, disgusted. With the screech and rumble of the east gate sliding open, I felt a mixture of relief and annoyance. Relief at our successful escape and annoyance at the amateur behavior of the guardsman. It was a shameful day for the Remnant Guard, arguably for the armed forces as a whole. Still, I held my breath until we passed the remaining checkpoints and started traveling across the terrain outside the base. About 10 clicks later, I felt the jeep pull to a stop. Seconds later, I heard Mercury laboring to remove the barrels above me. Grunting and breathing heavily, she removed them one by one. Mercury wasn't a particularly strong woman, so I had to admire the speed with which she worked. Within minutes, the barrels had been removed, and I pushed the plywood cover away. Mercury stood above me, wearing an outfit I hadn't had time to appreciate earlier. Mercury had changed out of her dirty laboratory coat into a pair of khaki pants and a plain white button-down shirt. A red scarf was tied around her neck, accenting her hair and face. Her attire was more suited to an afternoon's work in the sun than traveling across the wasteland. Still, I couldn't really blame her, since she had almost no survival experience. It was up to me to get her to her destination. Thank you, I said sincerely. Getting away from the Remnant was like a great weight being lifted off my back. I wouldn't have been able to escape without you. As much as I held nothing but contempt for her past actions, I did owe her my life. Mercury, however, didn't seem to be paying attention. Her gaze was squarely focused on my bare chest. Whether from sexual attraction or because she was looking at my unnaturally healed wound was anyone's guess. Are you all right? Mercury whispered, raising her hand to my shoulder. I took her hand from my shoulder. The wound is gone, but I feel queasy, like the insides of my body are burning. I rubbed the handprint scars left behind by my unnatural healing. Disturbingly, my own hand fit into the print perfectly. I briefly tried to think about possible explanations, before realizing I didn't have enough information to start guessing. Stepping out of the jeep, I took in the vastness of the desert around me. The terrain outside of New Arkham was a bleak, dusty, and cold ruin of an environment, with many small mountains torn up by the Great Old One's passage. The moon was high in the sky, stained red and no longer an object familiar to men of every age, as huge chunks of its surface were now missing. Sometimes I wondered what it must have been like to live in a world in which some things seemed eternal. A few albino rats with deformed heads crawled across the sands beside us. They were one of the many new animals which had emerged on post-apocalyptic Earth. Most normal animals had died in the ensuing disasters, with the survivors transformed forever. Others seemingly hailed from whatever world the Great Old Ones originally hailed, having slumbered beside them. It made the resulting ecology interesting, to say the least. I'm sorry, Mercury said, reaching into the back of the truck and pulling out a first aid kit. I've packed a lot of painkillers. I figured they'd help with the locals.
Thinking of becoming a drug dealer?
Yes.
Good idea.
Mercury sighed, sticking me in the bicep with her hypodermic. Not primarily, though. I intend to use my knowledge for the betterment of mankind. Flexing my arm a few times, I sighed.
If you think it'll help, humanity is in its final hour. We only have a few generations left before it's all gone.
I don't believe that, Mercury said. I think we'll eventually claw our way back to a place on the midsection of the food chain, if not the top. Ants survived in a world with humans, we can survive in a world with the great old ones.
It was strange to have this conversation now, especially after having a similar one with Martha less than an hour ago. But I could tell Mercury was uneasy about entering the wasteland. She wanted to believe there was hope. I wished I still did.
We should go now, I said.
I'm sorry for offending you, Mercury said. Here, have a fresh suit of clothes. Your others are still, well, blood-soaked.
It was a pair of jeans and a military-issue gray shirt.
Thank you. You're surprisingly nice for a torturer.
Mercury's eyes narrowed. I didn't choose this life. It was chosen for me. What made you want to be a soldier anyway? The glamour and glory of getting slaughtered by monsters?
Hardly, I said, reluctantly pulling on my new gray shirt. It was mostly because of my father, I suppose. I wanted to prove myself worthy of his legacy.
Your father who tried to kill you?
If there was any doubt that tact was not one of Dr. Takahashi's virtues, it was laid to rest.
Yes, I answered her question, savoring the clean desert air around us. I guess I just always wanted to make him proud. I admit, though, there was also my not inconsiderable desire to spite him. Becoming an R&E Ranger allowed me to illustrate who the better man was.
He wasn't your biological father, you know. It was in your file.
Mercury talked like her bringing it up was the most normal thing in the world.
I know, I said, wondering where she got off thinking this was an appropriate topic for us to discuss.
Sorry, do you know who your real father is?
Mercury asked almost immediately thereafter, apparently having no concept of privacy. I mean, did you ever try to find him?
My real father is Marcus Booth, I snapped, a little too harshly. He deserves that title, as opposed to the bastard who slept with my mother. Though technically, I supposed it was I who was the bastard.
Again, sorry?
Mercury raised her hands defensively.
I didn't mean to pry.
You're failing miserably.
Closing my eyes, I shook my head. It's all right, really. It's an old pain, but one that is never entirely healed.
I was pulled out of class when I was barely an adult to become a torture booth.
Mercury bit her lip, her voice having the same twinge of desperation she had earlier.
I can barely remember what normal human reaction is sometimes. My husband was certainly no help there. The only reason I married him was because the whole selection process is fixed.
That was one of the more poorly kept secrets of the Remnant. Old and powerful families could select the best mates for their children and themselves. Politicians especially got the most attractive spouses available. In a way, I'd been lucky to end up with Martha instead of a 72-year-old councilwoman.
You rescued me, Mercury, I said. I reluctantly used her first name instead of her title. I owe you my life. That doesn't mean we're going to become friends on this trip. I have other concerns which will take me away thereafter. We should probably avoid getting to know one another. Keep things professional.
Mercury lowered her gaze. Fine, if that's the way you want to be, we'll just sit here in total silence.
I stepped into the driver's seat of the Jeep.
Good.
Mercury took a seat beside me, leaving behind my dirty clothes in the middle of the desert as we started off once more toward our destination. Noticing her miserable expression, I decided to speak to her. It was the least I could do, after all.
All right, we can talk, just not about my past.
Good, Mercury said. Tell me about Kingsport. What's it like?
I have no idea, I admitted, smiling at my little bit of misdirection.
What?
I could hear her enthusiasm deflate in an instant.
You said you could lead me there.
I can. I didn't say I'd actually been there, though, I said, a wide grin on my face.
Mercury looked stunned by my words.
You bastard!
Remembering our earlier conversation about my parentage, I said,
that would be literally true, yes.
Mercury cursed up a storm thereafter. I chuckled and pulled the Jeep to a stop to take stock of our situation. The sun might come up in a few hours, or the night might last another 10. Night and day no longer functioned as they used to, the nature of reality having fundamentally changed with the great old ones rising, but the darkness was our friend. The Remnant would undoubtedly send someone after us. The loss of a military-grade Jeep was too great for them not to. However, they would hesitate to do so in total darkness.
The Council of Leaders' arrogance extended only so far when regarding the dangers of the wasteland. As long as only the stars and moon illuminated our path, we could travel in relative safety.
So you mean you've never actually been?
Mercury was still having difficulty wrapping her head around the fact she'd been tricked.
You played me?
That would be correct, I said, as I pulled out a pair of goggle-equipped masks from the glove compartment and tossed her one. Here, put this on.
What's this?
Mercury stared at it blankly. A dust mask, I replied nonchalantly before affixing mine. They're standard issue for R&E rangers and scavengers. We'll need to get proper coverings for the rest of our bodies before we get too far out into the desert. We don't want to be caught in a windstorm unprotected.
Oh.
She looked at the hideous thing before reluctantly putting it on. Her voice was slightly lower once it was firmly affixed to her face.
Why the deception? You could have told me about a dozen other locations instead.
I was tempted to say, because you had me tied to a chair where I was at your mercy. Instead, I just pulled my dust mask on with one hand and said, I didn't lie to you. I've done reconnaissance of the city's exterior, and I've spoken to a number of its citizens. I just neglected to tell you I've never actually been inside the city limits. The truth was, the Council of Leaders had been less than pleased to discover Kingsport was a thriving community with a population rivaling New Arkham's. They'd suppressed the information, and there'd even been talk of war. Their ridiculous overreaction had been one of the major reasons I'd lost faith in the Council. What sort of leaders felt more threatened by their fellow humans than EBEs?
What do you know about Kingsport, then?
Mercury was trying to hide her annoyance, which wasn't difficult since the dust mask obscured most of her features, presenting only leather, rubber, and a pair of glowing green lenses. The mask's night vision would provide us with additional visibility while we made our trek across the desert. It's a rebuilt city. The original populace died of war, plague, famine, and all the other usual ailments that followed the rising. However, a number of enterprising warlords took over the ruins and fortified them. Somehow they managed to regain electricity and other technological marvels. Strange lights constantly blink over the city, hence the name. It's a place of cults, commerce, gambling, prostitution, science, slavery, and trade.
That's quite an assortment.
Mercury whistled, staring into the night, though that just might have been the goggles.
Are you sure this is the best place to take me?
I can always take you back to New Arkham. I gestured with the wheel, briefly turning it as we passed over a sand dune.
No.
Mercury pointed at me, her eyes blazing. Don't even joke about that booth. Her reaction was a bit extreme for a woman who had, until recently, been one of the most securely placed citizens in New Arkham.
All right. Will we get there tonight?
I could hear the anticipation in her voice. Despite everything, she was excited about getting away from the Remnant. I wish I shared her enthusiasm. Not a chance, I said, my voice sounding somewhat sinister through the rebreather attached to the part of the mask near my chin. The solar cells won't hold out until then. Besides, we have to take our journey slow through infested areas. They're too dangerous to go through at top speed. We'd run the risk of bandits, mutated desert predators, or voracious EBEs.
Oh, couldn't we just outrun them?
No, I replied, unhappy with an untrained civilian at my side. Not the ones I know. Don't worry, we won't be camping out in the middle of the wasteland. If our battery holds out, I'll get us to scrapyard before morning.
Scrapyard?
She turned her head to stare out into the desert.
Did all naming convention go out the window when the world ended?
It's a scavenger's village just outside the desert. You'll love it, I replied, grinning under my mask. I was actually sure she'd hate the tough but insular community. It's between Mudflats and Shittown and Ghoul Pass.
You're making that up.
I wish I was.
Why there?
It's a good place. I admit, though, I'm going there for another reason.
Which is?
I need to consult with a ghoul.
Chapter 7
You know a ghoul?
Mercury asked, sheer disbelief in her voice.
Like a dog-headed, baby-stealing, flesh-eating ghoul?
I don't think Richard does any of those things. He is dog-headed, though. Ghouls were one of the largest near-human species which inhabited the world we now lived in. They were a divergent race from humanity, having interbred with things from other worlds or been altered by them, so they were immortal and possessed powers akin to a werewolf, albeit never changed shape.
They knew many things about the Great Old Ones and were not hostile to humanity. They did, of course, eat dead human bodies, but that was because fresh meat was hard to obtain nowadays. At least that was the argument Richard put forth. New Arkham's other soldiers killed any ghouls they encountered, which wasn't many, or their race would have long since destroyed us. My friendship with Richard, by contrast, had yielded many dividends.
It has a name?
Her tone changed to one of complete disgust. He has a name? I corrected her. Richard Allen Jameson. Richard grew up human, but changed when he reached adulthood. A changeling. Sometimes ghouls kidnapped human children, raised them as their own, and then sent them out to serve as agents among us. The ghoul children they left appeared as their own kind until their mid-30s. It was paranoia-inducing, to say the least, as something about their instincts always won in the end.
Booth, you realize knowing an EBE on a personal level is treason.
She might as well have been reminding me water was wet. Good thing I'm already a traitor. Mercury was silent for a long time thereafter. Curiosity eventually won out over disgust, however.
So what's he like?
He's a mechanic who likes music from the pre-rising era and loud Hawaiian shirts. I leaned back in the Jeep's artificial leather seats, feeling the worn springs beneath. Mercury blinked twice.
Uh-huh.
I paused, wondering how to explain my friend in a manner that would be believed. You'll meet him soon enough. The people of Scrapyard have a cordial relationship with the ghouls. They don't bother the ghouls, and the ghouls don't need anybody who isn't already dead.
Charming, Mercury said, looking disgusted.
I've seen worse arrangements. I was serious. People did what they had to do to survive, no matter how personally distasteful. I was no fan of the ghouls, but their relationship with Scrapyard was less exploitative than most. In any case, Richard is a mystic of sorts. If anyone can help me find out if Jessica is still alive and what happened to my squadron in the Black Cathedral, it's him. The Hawaiian shirt-wearing ghoul. Mercury repeated my description like she hoped it would sound less insane the second time around. The Hawaiian shirt-wearing ghoul, I repeated. It didn't sound any less crazy the third time around. Mercury paused, turning her attention back to the road.
What's Hawaii?
Some sort of pre-rising island paradise. I'd seen a picture of it once. The men and women wore flower necklaces.
I've never been to an island,
Mercury said, clearly realizing there wasn't much left to talk about in this particular conversation. Neither have I replied, staring out into the wasteland. We'd finally come out of the dust zone, and for that I was tremendously grateful. The land outside of the dust zone wasn't much better, but it was slightly less hellish. Brownish grass and sickly yellow-looking cacti dotted the landscape along with the occasional mutated animal. Dr. Takahashi took a particular interest in a two-headed coyote pack that hunted a hairless rabbit litter. Surprisingly, we didn't have any conflict with bandits or hostile non-humans along the way. The way was unusually clear, especially for this time of year. Eventually, we started coming across ruins, ancient dilapidated structures once inhabited by pre-rising humanity. They were an inescapable part of any wasteland journey. Most recon and extermination rangers cut their teeth on these particular ruins, looking for mutant stragglers or bandits hoping to intercept remnant convoys. These structures, which included everything from gas stations to schools, were a mixed sight. Most were half-collapsed at best. Others were eerily perfect, as if their owners had just stepped out for the night. Driving past them on decaying roads and shattered streets was always a sobering experience, however. Everywhere were reminders of the days when humanity had been great and powerful. A couple of ruined towns we passed showed signs of the most insidious of fates to befall old Earth humans, becoming tainted. These places still stank of rotting flesh and unnatural matter a century after terrifying mutations had taken their citizens. Their buildings showed signs of having been rebuilt with unclean materials, human bones and substances grown from the corpses of otherworldly monsters. Thankfully, these places were almost certainly uninhabited. The remnant had slaughtered their residents in my grandfather's time, leaving nothing alive which could remotely be called inhuman. Intelligent mutants were not necessarily evil, but a vast number of them were unable to handle their transformation, becoming enemies to humanity and everything else that lived. We had enough problems without having to deal with them. We were passing through the remains of something called a suburb,
a seemingly endless row of identical houses, each shattered in a different way, when Mercury asked me a strange question. Booth, do you really think we don't have a chance of making it?
I wouldn't be taking you if I didn't think we'd get there.
No, I mean the rising.
Mercury stared at the horizon as a glint of light began peering over the edges. The sun was rising in the east, on time for once. We already survived the rising, I muttered. The fact we're here is proof enough of that.
This isn't surviving. This is slowly dying out.
She gestured toward a billboard, still legible despite all odds. It said, Welcome to Block Springs, a model community. I think we're doomed, yes. It wasn't something I liked admitting, but I wasn't going to shy away from the facts, either.
I was an interrogator, John. I can tell when you're lying. What are you hiding?
I remember Martha's words about Dr. Ward's experiments, and couldn't help but wonder if they were true. Had he discovered some way to change humanity into something which could survive? The West boys were nothing more than reanimated cannon fodder, but I'd survive the Night Gaunt. What if he could save us? My men would have willingly died for something like that, but I couldn't bring myself to care. I wanted to kill him, and the fact it would save the human race was meaningless to that fact. God, was this why we were doomed? I think we could survive, I said, clenching my teeth. I just question whether the price would be our humanity.
I see, Mercury said.
You asked.
I did, didn't I? Let's move on. How many ruins are like this?
Mercury asked, thankfully distracting me from that line of thought. You get used to seeing them after a while. I lied again. You shouldn't worry so much about it.
If I don't worry about it, then who will? Mercury said. She had a point.
The guard then passed through an old half-ruined tunnel jutting out of a set of copper cliffs. The moment we exited the other side, I lightly applied the brakes. We were arriving at our destination sooner than we should have. What lay beyond was gorgeous. Stretching before us was Ghoul Pass, a place whose name did not encapsulate its loveliness. The canyon in which it rested was huge, stretching outward for at least a mile and a length closer to 20. Far below in the valley, created by some great old one's passage, were trees. Not the sickly brown or leafless things that sometimes clung to life in the wasteland, but gorgeous green things which stretched up into the air in defiance of the world's end. A few trails of smoke emerged from the villages inside the valley, tiny enclaves of man in the otherwise wilderness-filled enclosure. Mercury's mouth hung open in awe.
I don't believe it. It's dreamlike.
Dreams live in this world, I said, agreeing with her. For better or worse.
I've never seen so much green in my life, Mercury said.
I rapidly put our vehicle in park and watched her step out to look over the cliff's edge into the valley before.
People live there? Mercury asked.
Yes, I nodded, getting out of the car. They're a vassal state of the Dunwich tribes to the east. I don't approve of them entirely. Their rights to their gods can get a little extreme. However, they're overall a very ecological and self-sufficient people. In fact, I had a very complicated relationship with the Dunwich. They'd held me prisoner for months, and I'd learned to both respect and loathe them, since they'd tried to make me one of them, with the threat of death hanging over my head if I refused. I'd been forced to comply with the desires of their priestesses, forced to kill their enemies, and forced to put my mind so deep into their mindset I sometimes forgot I hated them. I'd managed to get away and back to New Arkham, but the consequences still haunted me.
There's so much life, Mercury whispered.
Yes. I took position beside her, having picked up a pair of binoculars before exiting the jeep. Removing my dust mask, I slid it into my pocket before scanning the horizon. They've already started planting the seeds of their trees beyond the borders of the valley. Something about the valley's foliage is remarkably durable. They attribute it to the blessings of their goddess, Shub-Niggurath.
Finally, a god who does something good.
Mercury couldn't help but continue to stare at the sight before her. I couldn't really blame her. I'd had much the same reaction when first viewing Ghoul Pass. It existed in defiance of the rising, showing life continued and would continue to do so in the face of Armageddon. Noticing the intense look on my face, she asked,
What are we looking for?
Danger.
Surely there can't be anything hostile in this place. It's like paradise.
There are things worse than serpents in this garden, I replied. The locals were only semi-friendly to my team at the best of times.
The only reason we were accepted that much is I had my team offer up sacrifices to shove Nigger off.
Who or what?
Don't ask. Surveying the landscape, I searched for the tiny little paths which existed between the trees. Despite its appearance of being a wild and untamed wilderness, Ghoul Pass was anything but. Its pagan settlers had carefully cultivated it, making it a source of food and protection for its human population. I'd charted every one of the paths for New Arkham, despite knowing they'd never bother to send trade delegations or even attempt to enforce some form of sovereignty over the place.
"Do you see anything?" Mercury asked impatiently. "Do you think they have apples? I've never had apples. They look delicious in pictures."
"Quiet." My eyes rested onto an unsettling sight. A caravan of travelers on foot, mixed with mutated, splotchy-skinned bears pulling carts, was moving down the path from Scrapyard. That wouldn't have drawn much concern if not for the fact that the travelers were heavily armed, tattooed and deformed bandits flying a golden-green banner containing the starfish-like elder sign. The Mark of Cthulhu was on several of their animals. It was a strange combination since the elder sign was a traditional ward against the Great Old One's influence. Were these wards people? More of the reanimation-capable tribesmen. My concern over their paraphernalia vanished when I saw the contents of their carts. The crude vehicles contained cages filled with children, dozens of children. There were a few adults mixed in, but most were adolescent or younger. Leading this dread procession was a priest wearing a homespun robe and a crudely stitched-together brown leather mask with tendrils hanging down the front of his face. Riding on the top of a hideous pale horse, the figure held up a staff tipped with a jewel-covered human skull. "Shit," I cursed.
"What?" Mercury said. "What's going on?"
"Slavers." I practically spit the word out. "Cthulhu worshippers, too."
"What? Them? Fuck."
"Yes," I said. Mercury had a layman's knowledge of the wasteland and only clinical knowledge of the Great Old Ones, but everyone knew the name of Cthulhu. Countless cults to the Great Old Ones existed in the wasteland, but the worst were the devotees of that particular monster. The cults of Cthulhu engaged in every form of perversity imaginable and claimed to possess supernatural powers of the highest order. All of this despite the fact none of them could produce any evidence that their god even knew they were alive, let alone approved of their actions.
"Damn,"
Mercury said as I handed her the binoculars. Taking a look at what I'd been gazing at, she sighed.
"Poor bastards."
"Not for long." I returned a few moments later, carrying a sniper rifle she'd packed.
"Booth, what the hell are you doing?"
Mercury stared at me while I placed the rifle on a tripod over the edge. "I'm about to snipe someone," I answered, stating the obvious. "Preferably a lot of someones."
"I can see that,"
Mercury said, confused.
"Why?"
"They're slavers." It should have been answer enough for any rational person. Traffickers and peddlers in flesh were the lowest of the low, below even the fact they were worshippers of the Great Old Ones.
"And?"
"They're slavers," I repeated, a little forcibly. "Deranged cultists, too. The fate that awaits their prisoners if we let them go is nightmarish. You haven't seen true horror until you've seen the after effects."
"I've tortured people."
Her voice held more than a little hint of scorn. Oddly, her attitude didn't reflect someone genuinely remorseful, which either meant she was a sociopath, or she had remarkable skills at compartmentalization. Then again, who was I to judge? I'd done plenty of things to survive in this world. The sounds of tribal people's screams as I gunned them down for trying to loot food from New Arkham caravans filled the back of my mind. Deciding to take Mercury at her word for the time being, I said, "Then I suggest you consider whether or not it's time for you to start paying humanity back for your actions." Mercury blinked, apparently processing what I just said.
"Go kill the bastards."
"Thank you." I put the leader of the caravan in my sights and proceeded to start shooting. Chapter 8. Sniper training was something every Arnie ranger underwent. Bullets didn't always kill what you faced in the wasteland, but when they did, you wanted to be as far away from your target as possible. The slavers below were, at least at first glance, human. That meant it should have been easy killing them all. Somehow I knew it wasn't going to be. It went well at first, my first shot going squarely through the lead slaver's masked skull. I then focused on a woman in a leather jacket.
She wore a necklace of finger bones, marking her as a trophy taker. She, too, went down easily enough. Following her was a man covered in blood-colored tattoos, sporting a mohawk and wearing a belt covered in scalps. I enjoyed killing them. It made me feel more human. This is justice, the only justice which exists in this world, the one I choose to deliver, I said, giving a grim smile as I shot a chubby-looking man who had filed his teeth down to razor-sharp incisors. Booth? Mercury leaned down and tapped me on the shoulder. Something's happening. Not now, I said, focusing in on the banner carrier for the slaver gang. He was running around, confused, not fully aware of what was going on, but desperate to find some cover. Unlike the rest of the gang, he hadn't yet found any. I mercifully relieved him of his life, taking a headshot which sent his body spiraling to the ground. Damn, the rest of them are behind their carts and slaves, I grumbled, falling back to find a new firing position. It was unlikely they could hit me from this point, but all of my efforts would be for nothing if they were able to get away with their cargo.
Booth!
Mercury called out.
Something's happening!
What? I looked up at her. That was when I noticed the light was disappearing from the sky. Whereas once there was a clear morning sky, a black set of clouds covered the entirety of the pass now. The air crackled against my face, now charged with static electricity. I knew instantly what was happening. A summoning. Not a small one like the one my wife had performed, either, but something big from the dreamlands or a distant world. Rotating my sniper rifle, I looked through the scope at the chief slaver's corpse. Despite having a visible hole through his head, he'd gotten up off the ground and was chanting. Waving his skull-tipped staff around, I realized I'd underestimated the magic of the wasteland. Bastard, I muttered before snapping the rifle's magazine into place and running back to the jeep. There I grabbed a case of flamer rounds. They hadn't been all that effective against the reanimated, but they were all I had right now. Reloading, I ran back to where I'd been lying before. I took position to aim at the magician, intending to finish the job I'd started moments before. The next shot took most of the chief slaver's head off, a second shot hitting him in the heart. From there, the man's body became a mass of fire. As his robes burned off of him, I saw hideous worm-like figures moving in the flames. Whatever it wasn't remotely human. Eventually, the worms collapsed into several disgusting piles and continued to burn. Unfortunately, it was too late to stop whatever the inhuman slaver had been doing earlier.
Booth, it's still coming!
Mercury shouted. I could hear her scrambling for a weapon in the back. Spinning around, I saw the ground underneath the jeep begin to crack. The Mark VII was carelessly thrown to the side as a huge, slimy, tapeworm-like creature bashed itself up through the ground. The top of its mouth opened up four separate mandibles to expose the vicious, gaping maw it possessed. I'd never known a worm to scream, but that's what it did, letting forth a cry into the air. Once it broke loose from the ground, it kept rising until it was close to 50 feet in the air. Yeah, that's bad. I made the understatement of the decade, staring up at the creature. I knew instantly what it was, one of the demon beasts of the abyss beyond time, an Earth Mover. I'd seen Earth Movers before. I'd witnessed the mammoth creatures devour whole regions of scrubland, transforming whatever they passed through into empty desert. This particular specimen was only a baby, yet it would destroy all of Ghoul Pass and anything else in the immediate area if it was left unchecked. Even worse would be what happened if it tasted human flesh. Once Earth Movers did, they entered a blood fury not quenched until they were destroyed. Unfortunately, I just killed the only person capable of sending the Earth Mover back where it came from.
What's the plan?
Mercury shouted as the creature reared its head and prepared to bring its mouth down upon me. She had a pistol in her hands, which sadly wasn't going to be of much use. Still, she got points for effort.
Run away!
I shouted, rushing out of the creature's path, watching it descend on the edge of the cliff and snap it off into the valley below, clearly trying to swallow me whole.
What?
Mercury shouted, seeking refuge behind the jeep that had just been turned over. The creature seemed to be disoriented, as much as you might discern the opinions of a slime-covered worm from another reality. That was about my only advantage, as the Cthulhu cultist's bullets bounced off against the monster's thick hide. Earth Movers, unfortunately, definitely fit under the category of things bullets didn't affect.
Running away is the plan,
I shouted as I grabbed Mercury by the arm and ran for the tunnel, watching the Earth Mover grab the Jeep with its mandibles and push it down its throat. It took only seconds to digest the remains, forcing it down its long, tube-like body. The creature was still half inside the cliff face, either partially still in its own home dimension, or burrowed in the ground beneath our feet.
"Yeah, this is bad," I muttered, realizing there was no way to get away from this thing. Earth Movers could be miles in length.
"Oh, no," Mercury said, looking at it. Handing her the sniper rifle, I nodded to her.
"Shoot at it!"
"Are you insane?"
"Probably."
I made a running dash to where the Jeep had been overturned. A number of items had spilled out on the ground when it was knocked over. Valuable items that just might mean our salvation. Mercury, showing she had courage to face the horrors of the wasteland, fired repeatedly. It didn't take much skill not to miss such a thing, but each shot bounced off against its otherworldly hide. That was expected. I just needed her to distract it while I made a grab for a bandolier of grenades which had fallen nearby. With the creature's attention focused squarely on Mercury, I pulled out a pin and hurled them all simultaneously at the base of the Earthmover's 60-foot stalk. They were designed to detonate if one exploded, a feature meant to kill EBEs rather than people. I had about 3 seconds before it swallowed her whole. It turned out I only needed one. The explosion was tremendous, causing a rumble through its body as bits of slimy flesh were thrown left and right. 6 grenades going off more or less at once wasn't enough to kill the thing. Instead, it just caused it to lose mobility. The mammoth creature fell over the side of the cliff face, its wounded body no longer able to support its weight. Now it was flailing about and doing its best to survive, a futile gesture given how much damage it had sustained. I ran over to Mercury's side and held her steady. She was clutching onto the sniper rifle, still firing from its rifle magazine. Even wounded, the creature lived several more minutes, finally ceasing its struggles as it bled out from the wounds I'd given it. I couldn't hate the creature. It had been brought here against its will and undoubtedly had been more confused than malicious, yet I wasn't sorry to see it perish. Earth Movers were too powerful to live on the same world as humanity. They belonged in whatever strange and distant realm where they had evolved. "Is it dead?" Mercury huffed, looking shell-shocked from both her first battle and the appearance of a being far above humanity.
"More likely, it's regenerating back on whatever world it was drawn from. We only saw a small portion of it." I shook my head. "The question concerning me now is whether the slavers are still alive." Mercury shot me a furious look, which was justified since I'd just gotten all of our supplies destroyed.
"Who gives a damn about the slavers?"
"The slaves," I replied.
I'd always had something of an eerie calm around the monsters of the Cthulhu cycle. Some had speculated that it was because there was something fundamentally wrong with me. Others believed it was a function of humanity finally adapting to the horrors around it, though few others displayed any such inclinations in the remnant. For me, I believed it was exposure to the blackest parts of humanity as a young child. My father's betrayal had shattered any sense of safety I might have had early on. There was nowhere to go but up. Mercury took a deep breath, calming her down. "Fine, go check on your natives."
"Of course," I said, thinking it strange it had only taken a few decades for the remnant citizens to start thinking of their fellow Americans as backward primitives unworthy of anything but scorn. That was one area where we were worse than the monsters and far from the last. Taking the sniper rifle from her hands, I looked through its scope back at the slaver's caravan. I discovered the remaining cultists had fled. I shouldn't have been surprised. Seeing their leader killed and the arrival of an Earth Mover was probably more than the average cultist of Cthulhu was prepared to deal with. Leaving Mercury behind, I started walking down a path carved into the side of the canyon's walls. Hopefully it would take me directly to the path they'd been traveling. Scattering the cultists wasn't enough. They could always just return later to reclaim their cargo. The slaves needed to be returned to their village and the remaining slavers hunted down. If I was going to make a difference in this world, I had to start with the human evils rather than the inhuman ones, mostly because the inhuman ones were too powerful for humanity even at its height. Hoisting my sniper rifle, more than a little angered I no longer had any of the other weapons we packed, I hoped I wouldn't have to engage any of the slavers at a short distance. The pathway was long and hard but not treacherous, which meant Mercury was able to catch up to me quickly. We were about halfway down when she started talking again.
That was interesting, Mercury said, walking close behind me.
She seemed almost exhilarated now, which was insane given what the Earth Mover could have done to us.
I've seen the Great Old One's servant races before, but that was the first time I've seen a genuine extra-dimensional being. That mutant we encountered in the wasteland was nothing compared to it.
An EBE is an EBE. I muttered the erroneous remnant adage before using my scope to scan the valley treetops one more time. If we went any farther down, we'd lose the high ground and any visuals they afforded. I didn't see any of the cultists through the thick foliage, which didn't mean they weren't there. I'd only killed a small portion of the slavers, and it wouldn't take more than the element of surprise to return the favor if the survivors came back.
Damn it. I hated unknowns.
So why did you do it? Mercury asked, surprising me. Do what? I said, holding my rifle before me as we finally reached the pass's surface. The trees were less magnificent up close. Instead, they were ominous. Despite the fact the valley's growth was less than a century old, all of the trees looked positively primordial. The tree trunks were twisted and creaked as a wind passed through their leaves. Most were covered in moss, ignoring the old scout adage that it only grew in the north. A few sprouted fruit from their leaves, but it was no recognizable human fruit, often resembling some bizarre hybrid between apples and oranges.
Intervene, Mercury said, trying not to show how the environment affected her.
Where I was wary, it was clear everything around her was a source of fascination. She actually paused to walk over and poke a 4-foot-tall mushroom, ignoring the fact doing so could be dangerous in the extreme.
I mean, you didn't derive any benefit from it. It also exposes us to considerable danger. Is it because you've made some pact with the locals?
It was the right thing to do.
No, seriously, Mercury said, patting me on the shoulder. You can tell me.
I remembered being briefly a slave of the Dunwich and the indignities I'd been exposed to. Indignities they'd expected me to be honored by. Mine was an empathy born of shared experience combined with the fact I liked killing. The remnant also kept slaves, though we called them workers, and I had no true moral high ground. Still, it was these lies which kept the human animal from fully comprehending its true darkness. I'd rather not talk about it. Unusual sounds emanated from the surrounding woodland. I'd been in Ghoul Pass on numerous occasions, but I'd never entirely trusted the mutated forest. There was an old wasteland legend. The woods had been created through the blessings of Shub-Niggurath, one of their so-called awakened gods. Dr. Ward had named her as one of the Great Old Ones. If she had blessed this place, it was touched by forces well above humanity's comprehension.
If you don't want to, that's your business. Just don't get me killed in the process.
I could tell there was real concern in Mercury's voice. I was a person to her, not a thing which could be casually discarded. It was more empathy than most of my countrymen had been willing to show me. I wondered how she could feel that kind of connection to a person she'd only known a few hours, and do the thing she'd done as the remnant's chief torturer. It was a paradox of humanity I hadn't solved.
Fine, I said. I'll do my thing and you do yours, but I'll make sure you're not killed before I bring you to Kingsport.
We're not killed, she corrected.
Of course.
Eventually, the two of us managed to find ourselves on the same path the slavers had been walking. There I saw the remains of the men I'd slain, mixed in with fresh kills. Scattered across the caravan's remains were 5 or 6 men slain by spear or axe. The children I'd seen imprisoned were no longer held in cages, but were even now being freed by a pair of individuals I recognized. The first of them was a brawny man who stood even taller than me, quite the accomplishment since I was considered something of a giant amongst the remnant's men. Handsome and intelligent-looking, Peter Goodhill had shaved his head since the last time we'd met. His tanned olive skin was also marked with crimson Dunwich tattoos, a Van Dyke mustache adorning his face. It was almost enough to disguise the fact he was a remnant deserter. Despite having apparently joined the Dunwich, Peter still looked a great deal like the soldier he'd once been. Wearing camouflage pants but no shirt, a pair of dog tags hanging down from his neck. In his hands was a submachine gun confiscated from one of the dead slavers, making any encounter between us one to handle delicately. In our last meeting, I'd tried to kill him for desertion. The fact he was still alive was testament to his skills, or the fact I hadn't been willing to die to kill him. I honestly wasn't sure who was the better between us. Peter was another one of the remnant soldiers who displayed no hesitation in killing or fear of the monsters. Indeed, like me, he was more comfortable with them than with regular humanity.
It made his banishment a sick joke as a punishment. Beside him stood a woman I believed to be one of the most alluring in the world. I was no man attracted to frail weaklings, and Catrin's taut yet distinctly feminine body had entranced me from the first moment I'd laid eyes upon her. A true-born Dunwich woman, her skin was bronzed by the wasteland sun, but otherwise Caucasian, while she wore homemade leathers in place of restitched old earth clothing. Like Peter, Catrin bore the tattoos of her tribe, though she sported many more. Each marked a particular deed of valor in their post-apocalyptic culture. Yet despite her exotic attire, she bore a stark reminder of the family I'd left behind. Her silvery white hair was the same color as my wife's, hanging down freely over her chest, past her breast.
"I hope you know these people," Mercury said, leaning over.
"That may make things worse," I whispered before saying. "Hello, Peter, Catrin." Mercury blinked.
"I wasn't being literal."
Catrin's response to my appearance was to draw a knife and throw it at me. I didn't move or react as it buried itself in the tree behind me. Looking at her, I raised an eyebrow. "I see you're still upset about my leaving you after the blood, right?"
"If I was still upset, Booth, you would be dead," Catrin said. "You helped us, though, and I'm willing to let the past rest."
Catrin had been one of those who had misused me while I had been a prisoner of the Dunwich. She had thought herself honoring me with her presence. There had been times I had wanted to kill her, and would have, if not for the fact, I had been fascinated by the wasteland lore she'd taught me. The Dunwich were a subset of humanity far better adapted to this world than the Remnant, and I'd used what I'd learned upon my return. From her tense stance, I imagined it pricked her pride to realize I cared only about her as a resource, and no longer could muster the emotion to even hate her. Both hers and Peter's presence here smacked of conspiracy. But for me, or something else? Were they plotting some mischief against the Remnant? It was no longer my concern. Only my squadron and revenge mattered now. I would die to kill Ward, not these two.
"John Henry Booth."
Peter lifted up his submachine gun, an Uzi variant that had clearly been custom-built from a half-dozen other guns.
"I should kill you where you stand."
"You can try," I said, nonplussed. If he joined the Dunwich, then he was subordinate to Catrin now. Their priests held power even greater than their warlords.
"Well, this is a friendly meeting. Are you this popular everywhere?" Mercury asked.
Peter looked at her funny.
"Is that who I think it is?"
"Dr. Takahashi." I nodded.
"Yes."
Peter smiled in admiration.
"A pleasure to meet you. I'm a big fan of your work."
Mercury's expression was even.
"That makes one of us."
Peter frowned.
"I see. Are you gonna try to kill us, Peter?"
I asked.
"Are you the guy who killed the Earth Mover?"
Peter looked between us.
"Yes,"
I said.
"Then no,"
Peter replied.
"Unless Catrin wills it."
Catrin looked at the worms on the ground and stomped on one with her wrapped foot.
"Not right now."
"I'm glad that's resolved." I nodded to Catrin before turning to Peter. "What are you doing here?"
"Hunting,"
Catrin said, staring at me.
Her unnatural blue eyes, completely lacking in whites, seemed to look directly into my soul.
"The servants of Dread Kaifulu came to Scrapyard and killed the sheriff. They then began burning houses, demanding a dozen children as a tithe. We agreed to go with them as slaves, intending to free them at a later date."
Cthulhu worshippers, taking children all but confirmed this was part of the same group we'd tracked to the Black Cathedral. I would have loved to interrogate the surviving slavers, but Catrin had made sure that was impossible. I wasn't entirely displeased with that, as I didn't just want Ward dead, I wanted all of his associates killed as well. Peter kept his machine gun ready.
"We broke out of our cage when someone started shooting our captors, including the High Priest. What are you doing here?"
"Passing through?" I wrinkled my brow. "I think I may have been tracking these slavers beforehand. I seek the Black Cathedral."
"Why?"
Catrin said, her expression revealing nothing.
"To kill everyone inside."
Catrin nodded.
"Then our purposes are aligned. I will spare your life until the time we have revenged ourselves on the necromancer who leads them."
"Good," I said, not trusting her in the slightest. "We have an accord, then. For now."
Chapter 9. Checking the children's health was our first priority.
the lives of the next generation being paramount, were one of the few areas on which New Arkhamites and Dunwich agreed. A quick examination, followed by a short series of questions, told me much. They were a mixture of boys and girls of primarily Hispanic descent, between the ages of 8 and 14. They were all in reasonably good condition, if traumatized. The children had been forcibly separated from their parents at gunpoint and forced to watch a battle. That would leave scars on any psyche. With time and love, however, they would survive. Children were more durable than most people gave them credit for. Afterward, our group proceeded on foot toward Scrapyard. Catherine and Peter took point while we covered the rear. The children walked in between us, as safe as they could be given the circumstances. Scrapyard wasn't far, but it was a potentially hazardous journey to the unwary. Even in relatively settled woods of Ghoul Pass, there were many dangerous predators and toxic plants. Mercury was a loud traveler, her feet crunching against the leaves on the ground. The children also moved loudly, signaling our presence to all the individuals around us. Despite that, Catrin was almost completely silent moving through the foliage. Peter and I split the difference, moving as R&E Rangers were trained to do. Softly. As we walked, I thought about the slaver's curious choice of prey. For obvious reasons, slavers preferred attractive adults or ones capable of skilled labor. Children were usually taken with their families and sold at a discount, if at all. There were a few groups which bought children, to be raised by communities or sacrificed to the great old ones, but their involvement only raised more questions. The second issue I had with the situation was Catrin's and Peter's presence. Ghoul Pass was technically under the control of the Dumwitch, but their territory was vast, consisting of nearly the entirety of the eastern grasslands. The odds of encountering two people I knew well were low. The odds of them being on a quest similar to mine were almost non-existent. Catrin would call it destiny. I called it suspicious.
John, can I ask you a question? Mercury asked.
Yes, I sighed, getting used to her inappropriately timed questions. Mercury leaned up to my ear.
What the hell were you thinking?
I don't know what you mean. I really didn't. I'd made a lot of recent questionable decisions.
Taking us into their group?
Mercury gestured to Catrin and Peter.
I won't be a Dunwich slave.
I won't let that happen to you, I promise. I let her fill in the blanks. I would slit her throat before she was taken and go down fighting first, before I returned to the life I'd escaped. The Dunwich had not been worse than death, few things were, but I wouldn't let myself be distracted from my quest. Mercury looked at me like I just asked her to leap into a pit of rabid wolves. I was about to say more when my eyes caught glimpse of a colorful feathered serpent, a coatl, one of the deadliest killers in the wasteland. Its venom would kill a man instantly, melting him from the inside out. The creature lowered itself from the top of a branch, ready to pounce on one of the girls in an unnatural display of aggressiveness. Grabbing it by the base of its jaws, I squeezed the animal so tight with my bare hands it couldn't squirm free, then watched it die before tossing it away.
Beautiful!
An 11-year-old, red-haired girl with pale skin stared up at me. I hadn't meant for any of the children to see me handle the danger to them. I feared it would cause a panic.
Where did you learn to do that?
Advanced training, I said, seeing the quaddle come back to life, then slither away. What's your name, girl?
Jackie Howard.
The girl smiled, showing her surprisingly prominent teeth.
Are you an R&E Ranger? My dad told me they were the greatest warriors in the world.
Something like that, I said, smiling. Miss Howard reminded me of my daughter, Anita. Anita was nearly a woman now, 16 in January, but she'd always be a little girl in my eyes. I'd missed her last two birthdays. Don't worry, we'll get you back to your parents.
My parents are dead.
Jackie stared at the ground, her voice strained.
I have no one in Scrapyard.
I'm sorry, I said, seeing Catrin take us off the path into a denser part of the surrounding woodland. From what I gathered of her position, it would shave considerable time off our journey. I agreed with her decision. Speed was more important now than comfort, especially with children in our ranks. Mercury, you have good reason to trust Catrin and Peter as long as we're with them. It was a lie, but I didn't want to offend our temporary allies. The Dunwich were too dangerous an enemy to irritate, and I couldn't do harm to Peter as long as he was one of them.
Why is that?
Mercury huffed, clearly not liking how the power dynamics had shifted in our relationship.
Because you need me and I can't beat them, I responded, weirdness going on with my body aside. If you could call coming back from the dead weirdness, perhaps I now had more in common with the Coatl I just killed than humanity. Disturbing thought. Mercury stared. I see. I didn't want to deal with allaying her fears, but there was no point in putting it off. If it makes you feel any better, I can tell you where I met them. Will I trust them more? I could hear the uncertainty in her voice. The encounter with the Earth Mover had shaken her, appropriately so. Right now she needed the comfort of a friend. Unfortunately, all she had was me. Maybe, I said. They rescued me from the color, for some definition of the word rescue. The color? It was clear she had difficulty processing the concept. Yes, the color. A terrible, indescribable thing from another world. You would think I'd be used to such things, but something about it frightened even me. I could still remember the mission in my darkest imaginations. So much horror and death, it was a wonder I was still sane, if I ever was. It all began about a year ago when a meteor shower struck the city of New Ipswich. Do you remember? Sort of hard to forget, Booth. Every man, woman, child, and dog was killed. Even the plant life was reduced to ash. A whole city gone within hours of the first distress calls, Mercury said before shaking her head. That relates to your story? Yes, I said coldly. I was there, so was Peter. We were both assigned to the Arnie squadron sent to investigate. Compared now to what had happened in the Black Cathedral, it was not the worst mission I'd ever been on. Yet before I would have called it the most terrible struggle of my life. You can't describe it as something physical, Mercury. It wasn't flesh, metal, plant, or animal. It was just a color that human eyes cannot view on the spectrum of light. Something not from this world or any world that humans could possibly imagine. I believe you, Mercury said. She didn't understand, couldn't really, even after her encounter with the Earth Mover. Some things had to be experienced firsthand. When we arrived in New Ipswich, we saw it had been destroyed, wiped completely off the map. Everyone reduced to powder as if the life had been sucked from their bodies. In the center of the town there were meteorites, I continued, remembering the devastated remains of the city and its vampirized populace. From those fallen stars raised a collection of tiny lights which twinkled in a beautiful but sickening way. Maybe they were drawn by the rising. Maybe they just arrived here by accident. I don't know. But they formed a swarm which drained the life of anything it touched. What happened? Mercury asked, her voice finally becoming understanding. We fought, or tried to. Our weapons couldn't harm it. It was on a world with conditions totally unlike our own. I lowered my head. Our entire backup perished, and then we started to die one by one. All except those who chose to run. Just run. Like Peter. I left his name unspoken. I'd never forgiven him for that act of desertion. Still, he'd stayed long enough to show he was a capable soldier. Only Gamma Squadron had emerged from the battle unharmed, but those who'd fought beside us that day were the best of the best. Anyone who survived even a short time proved his mettle. I still had nightmares about that day. You'd have thought the other missions would have drowned out the horrors of it through sheer numbers by now. Those that stayed continued to fight. Beta and Gamma teams were devastated, their courage and skill meaning nothing against it. I would have died too if not for Gamma Squadron's leader. General Ashton Smith managed to temporarily scatter the color with a set of radiation grenades. Temporarily.
Wow, that's horrible,
Jackie said, surprising me. I realized to my horror she and every other child was listening to my story with rapt attention. I blinked, taking a deep breath as I flushed with embarrassment. This is not the sort of story for young ears. Peter shouted from the front of the line. Oh, come on, John, keep telling us your story. You're doing a wonderful rendition of a half-mad soldier. This entire situation felt off. Peter had forgiven me far too quickly. He was plotting something, I was sure of it. In any case, I don't see why you can't finish the story. You were there as well. I left that part of my past behind, Peter said. You seem to have, but I can tell you're still carrying it on your back. There was something hesitant in his voice, as if he was trying to hide his emotions under a false facade of cheerfulness. I knew the feeling. There was also a glimmer of hate in his voice. I knew that feeling, too.
Due to my report, Peter was exiled from the Remnant. I'd almost killed him, and he'd nearly done the same, the two of us shooting up a section of these very woods, but a group of feral ghouls had been attracted by the noise and forced us to part ways. I'd hoped they'd finished him off, but they'd obviously done no more to him than me.
What a bastard, Mercury muttered under her breath. Why don't you go on with your story?
There's not much left to tell. With the color temporarily scattered, we found ourselves wandering across the desert supplyless and alone. A Dunwich war party found us. Catrin was its leader. We were defeated and taken captive.
What, really?
Mercury's astonishment was clear. Looking at Catrin's backside, she tried to put her surprise into words.
But she's, you were soldiers. Armed soldiers. I mean, she's got a spear, John.
A blessed spear is more effective than firearms against many creatures of the wasteland. Catrin answered Mercury's unspoken question. The Dunwich do not disdain technology, though we do not embrace it either. Better we forge a new life than exist forever picking over the ruins of a dead civilization.
John, were we just insulted there?
Mercury blinked. Yes, I said, not concerned about it. The Dunwich may be descended from a bus of tourists that got marooned on some surprisingly durable farmland near Sentinel Hill, but that doesn't mean they're not capable.
You're kidding, Mercury said.
Yes, because I'm such a kidder. I rolled my eyes.
Yeah, you are,
Mercury surprised me by saying.
In a dry wit sort of way.
Catrin interrupted, perhaps not enjoying having her racial heritage summarized so.
To continue John's story, my people have had encounters with monsters from the sky before. The Seeing Stones read that John Henry Booth would be able to find a way to defeat the indescribable thing from the stars. We decided to spare the survivors' lives and not take them as slaves if they agreed to help us avenge our losses. The color from the sky had killed a Dunwich village hours before. It had simply returned to its nest thereafter.
What did you do?
Jackie, of all people, was the one to speak. I was appalled she'd been listening to our grisly tale. We lured the swarm to an abandoned mine and detonated a nuclear warhead, one of New Arkham's remaining six. It destroyed the enemy. I allowed them to think the color was dead. I had to do it, despite the terrible truth that the color could not be killed. I knew on some instinctive level it had just been buried under 1,000 tons of rock. Someday the color might leak into the groundwater or rise through the cracks in the rubble above it. That day humanity would meet its end.
That's incredible, Mercury said, genuinely impressed.
A fact which confused me. After all, I just described how the three R&E squadrons had been almost completely helpless against an EBE, and how we'd won only through blind chance. Catrin finished off my tale, covering a part I was uncomfortable narrating. I sealed the creature beneath the mine with 12 spells and the lifeblood of traitors who had run away during the final battle. I invited Captain Booth to become a member of the Dunwich. We stayed together for a short time, but there was no fruit from our union. He disappeared soon after, an affront to the gods.
I thought you didn't bed murderers, Mercury asked, biting her lip. Pretty sure she qualifies.
I said willingly, I said, not wanting to get into it.
Oh, Mercury muttered.
Catrin sniggered in unexpected reaction. Peter, by contrast, looked annoyed. Are we almost there? I asked, anxious to break the silence.
Yes,
Catrin pointed, moving aside some tree branches. From there I caught a glimpse of Scrapyard, a town literally made of junk. Much of the remaining pre-rising machinery had decayed to unusable refuse, even when humanity struggled vainly to keep it perfectly intact. That meant gathering new examples from the ruins of humanity was a thriving business. Scrapyard positively reveled in this trade, stacking countless bits of antique garbage left over from old America around them. If something was irreparable, more common than not, it might provide a glimpse about how to construct something similar. Houses were made of welded together metal sheets, cars and pieces of shattered houses slapped together. Piping ran through the entire town, hundreds of twisting and spiraling bars linking up to the town's tiny windmill power plant. It was ghastly and beautiful at once. The children, upon seeing their home, didn't waste any time in running inside. The townsfolk, a strange collection of tribals and tinkerers, immediately rushed out to greet them. Alone, Jackie stayed behind. She just looked at the town with a mixture of sadness and longing. I understood her feelings. We were both without a place in this world.
Chapter 10.
Scrapyard was officially a holding of the Dunwich tribes, which meant its warriors occasionally came by to say, "Send us tribute or we'll kill you." As a result, Catherine and Peter were treated with a wary respect by the locals. Likewise, I was a known quantity in Scrapyard. It was a small enough community that everyone remembered me from my previous visits. The town salvagers didn't necessarily have any love for remnant soldiers, but we'd done favors for them and brought trade. The invisible, unacknowledged trade which the remnant depended on and the people of Scrapyard had benefited from. As the children were gathered in the town square, they were picked up one by one. Parents and relatives collected them, sometimes with tears of joy, and other times with a cold, sullen resentment. But collect them they did. During the process, I hoped some noble soul would come and collect Jackie. Yet after all citizens of the town had visited us, Miss Howard stood alone. In small towns like Scrapyard, blood ties ran deep. If you couldn't find a person's parents, you were able to find someone related to them. Grandparents, uncles, or cousins could usually be counted on to take care of a child if something happened to their parents. Even when whole bloodlines were wiped out, due to plague or blood feud, neighboring families were usually willing to take in a child. The fact that Jackie wasn't spoke volumes about how she was treated here. Mercury, tactful as ever, observed this.
"You're not terribly popular around here, are you, girl?"
"Mercury," I snapped. Jackie answered her question without offense.
"My mom got pregnant collecting fruit in the valley. No one knew who the father was, and my mom died giving birth before she told anyone. They thought it might be a mutant or a ghoul or something. That scared them. Only the sheriff, my dog, was willing to take me in. The others, they were happy to give me up after the slavers killed him."
"I see," I said, unsure how to respond. I couldn't help but see parallels between her situation and my own, which frightened me since I'd have seen the villagers' actions as reasonable not long ago. Catherine leaned over and put a comforting hand on Jackie's shoulder.
"Do not worry, child. We will hunt down any surviving slavers and spill their blood on the fields."
"Good," Jackie said, before looking up and smiling weakly. I expected Mercury to recite some bullshit statistic about how, anthropologically speaking, it was probably safest to reject Jackie from the community. Instead, she raised a fist.
"Booth, I have to take care of this child."
That got a single-word response from me.
"What?"
"Anthropologically speaking, it's good cultural instinct to adopt children without parents." Mercury pointed to the air as if lecturing. "They can be taught skills from a young age, which strengthens your chance of survival."
"Uh-huh."
Jackie looked up uncomfortable.
"I don't know how I feel about that.
You should help me, Booth," Mercury suggested, "after you murder everyone at the Black Cathedral."
"There is no after."
"Ha!" Peter let out a hearty laugh. "Escape one family and immediately get another. You have no luck, do you, John?" My response was simple. "Fuck you, Peter." Turning back to Mercury and me, Catherine said, "If the girl proves too difficult for your journey, my tribe will offer her sanctuary. We have ways of discerning if her blood is mutated or of the old races. You have my word by the old gods that if it is, I will deliver her to her true people. If not, she may stay on as a member of our tribe." Jackie looked terrified rather than reassured. The Dunwich were a bigger boogeyman than the great old ones to the people of Scrapyard, let alone the promise to hand her over to what Jackie undoubtedly thought were monsters. Taking a deep breath, I knelt down so I was nearly eye level with Jackie, trying not to smile at the display. This was a serious subject. "I will find someone to care for you. You have my word."
"Thank you,"
Jackie said, staring up into my eyes. They were big and innocent despite what she'd endured. That would not last.
"With the exception of one incident, John Henry Booth is an honorable man."
Catherine blinked her deep blue eyes and nodded solemnly, ignoring what the girl was saying.
"You would do well to believe in him, child."
"Yeah, John is really honorable," Mercury nodded, "except for the whole treason, lies, and revenge thing." I glared at her. Everyone trotting over the girl's grief was obscene. "I may have lied to you about visiting Kingsport, but I will get you there."
"I'm holding you to that. In any case, I want her to come with us until you find an acceptable alternative guardian,"
Mercury said, patting the young girl on the back.
"That is, unless you want to accompany me to Kingsport. I'll teach you how to do medicine and you can become a doctor. Eventually, with our superior knowledge, we can rule the wasteland."
Jackie smiled, probably respecting the sentiment, even as she was, even now looking at Mercury like she was insane.
That's nice. Really.
Thankfully, Catherine changed the subject.
I would have words with you, John. If your quest actually means anything to you, we must share information.
I have every intention of doing so, Catherine. I trusted the Dunwich priestess about as far as I could throw her, but she knew more about what was going on in the wastelands than I ever would. However, my feeling is a matter which takes precedence.
Yeah, Booth has decided he needs to meet with a Hawaiian shirt-wearing ghoul.
Mercury didn't conceal her disbelief. I was beginning to wonder if someone had ever explained the concept of tact to her.
Ah, yes, Richard Jameson.
Catherine nodded her head solemnly, tightly clutching her spear. The Dreamwalker. Mercury blinked.
He wasn't making that up?
Ignoring her, I turned in the direction of Richard's workshop, near the far edge of town. Jackie then grabbed hold of my pant leg.
Can I come, Mr. Booth?
I looked down at her, wondering why she was so panicked. Then I saw the eyes of the people around us. They were accusatory, distrusting, and occasionally even hateful. It was a monstrous reaction to a girl whose father had just been murdered. If Jackie was left alone, she might not survive. It seemed only the former sheriff's protection had kept her alive before. Of course, young one.
Booth?
Mercury paused. I'm not sure taking her with us to see a ghoul is wise.
I don't mind Mr. Jameson, Jackie said. He treats me like family.
That was unsettling. I see. Silence reigned until we reached our destination on the other side of town. Jameson's Salvage and Reconstruction was a unique building in a town composed of unique buildings. It was in many ways a castle composed of junk. The original pre-rising garage was still visible in the central courtyard, but it was surrounded by a fortress of pipe and steel. Concrete smokestacks had been constructed to handle the interior smelting furnace, as thick walls made of abandoned cars surrounded the place. The strange building stood in the direct shadow of the town's windmills, with a number of power lines running toward the garage's rooftop. Despite this connection, it was clear Richard didn't rely on the town's own meager supply of electricity to satisfy his energy needs. He had his own windmill and a large number of solar panels lining the top of his roof. He probably had more power than the rest of the town put together. The dwelling had a rather pungent odor, a mixture of stench from nearby pig pens mixed with an earthy corpse-like smell. Mutated hairless rats popped in and out of the wall erected around his home, all of them hideous and red-eyed. Arriving at a thick wrought iron gate, I wondered how I'd begin our conversation. Hello, Richard. Long time no see. Would you mind working some sorcery on me? That was a conversation I was not looking forward to.
This is not what I was expecting, Mercury said, staring at the place.
What were you expecting?
Something more cyclopean.
Many noises were coming from within his shop. Today, in addition to the din of tools at work, there was the sound of old earth rock and roll coming from within.
What is that ghastly din?
Mercury looked vaguely horrified by it.
Ghoul music?
Catherine corrected her.
I believe it is called Gas on the Lake.
Smoke on the Water.
Richard's voice called from inside the building, apparently able to hear us from 40 feet away. That was when the shocking figure stepped out, the sun illuminating a figure of absolute terror. Chapter 11. The nightmarish figure stepping out caused Mercury to seize up in horror, choke, and look ready to vomit. I, Catherine, Peter, and even little Jackie had more subdued reactions to Richard's arrival. We merely looked uneasy, even if every instinct in our bodies told us to run away screaming. I was surprised to see Jackie was so good at it, given her young age. Most children her age would have screamed, cried, and run away. Hell, most adults. Ghouls were a hideous sight by human standards. They had claws, fur, pointed ears, ugly hoof-like feet, and warty yellow-green skin. Their faces were the most unnerving thing about them, being an unnatural cross between a man's and a wolf's. Worse was how expressive they were, showing all of the emotions a human could, but in a twisted fashion. Richard was a particularly repulsive example of his species, standing closer to the middle ground between man and monster than most. He was a walking, talking reminder of how close the relationship between our two species was. As if to compensate for it, the ghoul wore outlandish attire. Today it was a bright red shirt covered in pineapples, jean shorts, and sandals. It was such a ridiculous sight that for a moment the dissonance seemed to relax Dr. Takahashi.
"Howdy, neighbor,"
Richard said, walking up to the gate between us. I'd often wondered why Richard chose to live amongst humans of scrapyard, despite the prejudice he must endure. The only answer I'd ever gotten from him was,
"Ghouls are immortal, but only humans know how to live."
"Hello," I said, giving a pleasant wave to Richard, trying to hide my revulsion.
"It's good to see you."
Finally, Mercury managed to say,
"Hello, Richard."
"Hey, Mr. Jameson."
Jackie waved to him, unafraid.
"Why, hello, little Jackie."
Richard leaned down to look at her square in the eyes.
"What are you doing here?"
"My dad died,"
Jackie said.
"He was killed by slavers. These folks killed them."
Richard looked down at her as if processing the information.
Yeah. I heard some commotion in the village square earlier. I decided it wasn't any of my business. I'm sorry."
"It's okay,"
Jackie said.
"They're weird, but I like them."
Uncomfortable, I coughed into my left fist before saying, "Richard, I have need of your peculiar expertise."
"First, introduce me to your companions. I have to be wary of strangers,"
Richard said, smiling his demonic-looking canines.
"Monsters aren't always obvious."
"Yes, I agree," I calmly answered. "You know, Katrin, this is Dr. Mercury Takahashi."
"Nice to meet you."
Richard extended his hand to Mercury. Mercury looked at the inhuman clawed grip.
Right.
Richard chuckled sadly, pulling his hand back.
"So what have you been up to, Katrin?"
"Hunting individuals who have been kidnapping children so I can crush their skulls and turn their teeth into jewelry,"
Katrin answered.
"So, the usual,"
Richard said, grinning.
"I was wondering when you'd return. Honestly, given the condition you left in, I wasn't entirely sure I'd ever see you again."
I blinked, unsure if I'd heard that correctly.
"I was here?" "Yes, you and Jessica."
I reached through the gate's bars, grabbing his shirt. It was a ridiculous gesture, since Richard could rend me limb from limb.
"Tell me everything." "You wandered in here extremely delirious with a girl."
Richard tried prying my fingers off his shirt, failing until I released him.
"So Jessica,"
I said, still stunned.
"She's here?" "Yeah,"
Richard said, looking down at her with deep, soulful eyes.
"You two mounted an escape from the place where you were imprisoned. Jessica was badly injured, some sort of infection."
"Go on."
"I've been treating her with the old black magic. So far, no luck. Jessica just keeps getting worse and worse."
"I see," I said, feeling stricken. "I found her just in time to watch her die."
"It happens,"
Richard said, spitting a cigarette onto the ground.
"Oddly, John, I thought you were the one who was going to die for the longest time. Then one day you just got up in the middle of the night and wandered into the desert."
Another piece of the puzzle fell into place. It didn't explain how I'd gotten to New Arkham, though. That was almost 80 miles away. "Please, Richard, bring me to her. I beg you."
"Okay, sure, John,"
Richard said, opening the gate and letting us through.
"But remember, you owe me. What'd you come here for anyway?"
I still needed to find out who'd done this to her. There was a chance she wouldn't be able to tell me. "I need another favor."
"Lovely, the tab just keeps running up,"
Richard said.
"Please,"
I whispered.
"I didn't say I wasn't gonna do it,"
Richard said.
"Just note, immortal things remember what humans do not."
"How did you two guys meet anyway?" Mercury asked. "You're, not exactly the sort of people who would normally hang out together." Richard started back toward his workshop.
"What with him being a recon and extermination ranger and me being the exterminated?"
"Yeah," Mercury said sheepishly. Jackie took Mercury's hand and walked beside her as we reached the entrance to Richard's garage. "He was a friend of General Ashton Smith, my mentor," I said, recalling another person I would never see again. "The general always had unconventional ideas about how exactly to protect the remnant. Richard and I struck an odd friendship after being introduced."
"Yeah, just a boy and his dog, man,"
Richard said.
"Watch your head."
The sounds of old Earth music continued to play in the background as we ducked under the half-closed garage door. The song currently playing was one I'd heard before, an ethereal melody called Dark Side of the Moon. The inside of Richard's workshop was a wonderland if you were interested in old Earth technology. The place was dark, greasy, smelly, and covered in soot, but there were more innovations going on here than in most of human civilization. There were stacks of recycled paper covered in charcoal scribbles of machinery parts, clay tablets preserving lost knowledge, and even technical diagrams written on the wallpaper. Hundreds of pre-rising homemade items had been disassembled and looked at closely under glass-blown magnifying glasses, while stacks of identical machines showed Richard's methodical devotion to his craft, the craft of tinkering. Scrapyard lacked the infrastructure to maintain or repair most of the more complicated pieces of machinery it salvaged, but Richard had taken it as an affront to humanity losing any of its technology. So far, he'd managed to construct items up to the 1960s in complexity, and was slowly building his way up. There was even a half-completed plane hanging from the garage's ceiling.
"Is that a computer?"
Mercury blinked, pointing at a strange hybridized thing with a greenish-tinged screen.
"You have computers out here?"
"Yeah, I mostly use it to play old video games. I used to be able to watch movies on it before the drive busted and the monitor failed. Still, it was an experiment which taught me quite a few things. Once we get computers back, it'll be smooth sailing."
Richard took position in front of a door marked Employees Only. Pointing, he said,
"The girl's in here."
"Ghouls are interested in computers?"
Mercury showed little interest in Jessica's fate, not that I expected her to.
"No, but humans are. I used to be one, you know."
Richard chuckled before a look of pain passed across his face. His face was similar enough to a human's that I could recognize the emotion.
"I know, it's hard to tell."
Not hesitating, I rushed past my friends through the doorway. Inside was a crude medical station equipped with some salvaged hospital equipment. It was inferior to a remnant hospital, but not for lack of trying. IVs, monitors, sterilized equipment, and so on had been placed inside the room, while the place smelled of antiseptic. Richard had done his best to see Jessica was taken care of, for which I owed him a huge debt. There, lying on an ancient, rusted hospital gurney, was Jessica. She was naked under a well-washed, frayed white sheet with a tube injecting homemade morphine into her arm. Her long brown hair trailed over the side of the bed, while a couple of strange humming machines kept track of her life signs.
"Thank you," I said, grateful for what Richard had done. "Save your thanks for when she makes it out of this alive," Richard said. "If she makes it out alive."
My relief at finding her died in the pit of my stomach as I saw a marking on her shoulder. My joy was short-lived, however, turning to a disturbed awe as I saw a handprint made of scars on her right shoulder. It was identical to the one on my own.
"Richard, what's wrong with her?"
I had to ask, a horrible sensation welling up inside my stomach.
"You know things we don't even know we've forgotten."
"John," Richard trailed off. I grit my teeth. "Tell me what's wrong with her." Richard looked sympathetic but nevertheless answered.
"As far as I can tell, John, you are."
"Explain," I said. It was more a command than a request. Catherine stepped past Richard and moved to press her hand against Jessica's scar.
"The Dreamwalker does not have to. I have seen this before. It is the hand of Nyarr Lathotep. Just once, I swear, I wish there would be a wasteland god or monster with a name that wasn't unpronounceable,"
Mercury muttered, looking in on Jessica. She then switched topics and said,
"She's pretty. Got some good genes there. No sign of mutation."
"Your observations aren't helping," I said, before looking between Richard and Katrin, trying to regain control over my emotions.
"Could you explain? Why is she like this?"
Richard stood in the doorway, his larger-than-normal frame blocking Mercury and Jackie from entering.
"The tribal lady seems to understand more about this than I do. All I know is she was getting better until this morning when she suddenly took a turn for the worst."
A sinking feeling filled my chest. I was not a believer in coincidence.
"Did it start happening about 6 to 7 hours ago?"
"Yeah, how'd you know?" Richard looked perplexed, as much as a human-canine hybrid could at least.
"Because that was about the time I was impaled by the Night Gaunt." I didn't say it aloud, but I could see it on Mercury's face. She was thinking the same thing.
Somehow there was a supernatural connection between Jessica and me, one that was slowly killing her. I had to figure some way of stopping it, no matter the cost, even if it was at the expense of my own life.
Katrin took her hands up to my chest and slowly removed my shirt, exposing the handprint.
You have been marked by the God with a thousand forms, John, the one you call the Black Soldier, who we call the Trickster, and who is known by countless other names. Some dreadful sorcery has been worked, feeding your life with this woman's own. When you suffer, she suffers. Yet as long as she has life left to give you, you will recover from even the worst wounds. This is the nature of the hand of Nyarlathotep.
I felt sick to my stomach, stunned at such a horrible thing's possibility. What sort of mad sorcerer had worked this enchantment on us? Was it Ward? If it was, I needed to find out so I could rip off their head and put it on a pike.
Sounds like a pretty sweet deal to me. Too bad it has to be such a hot young thing, Richard said, shrugging his shoulders. No wonder I wasn't able to get her to wake when you left. You crossed the dust zone without any clothes or water. I'm surprised she didn't die a dozen times getting you back home.
Wow, that's even more tactless than my usual comments. You should be proud, Mr. Jameson, Mercury said, shaking her head.
Just doing my part, Richard said, smiling a mouthful of sharp teeth. I can sound human even if I'll never be so again.
I felt helpless and in need of something to shoot. Mercury reluctantly squeezed past Richard's thick furry form. Let me have a look at her. I'm a doctor.
Is she?
Richard sounded impressed. Something like that, I corrected, not at all happy Mercury was getting near Jessica. Unfortunately, she was the only one here with any real medical expertise. I wanted to say more, but I was still in shock and couldn't think of anything else to add. How do I break the spell? I asked, deciding to focus on what was important.
She's quite beautiful.
Catherine's eyes lingered over Jessica's fallen form. But you need to think pragmatically. A true warrior would be willing to die for their leader. If you truly wish to kill the necromancer, I suggest you allow her to serve as your shield. She will give you the strength you need to destroy him.
I was her captain. I still am,
I snapped, disgusted by Catherine's words. I'm not going to use her as some sort of battery. It's my job to keep her safe. Do you understand? It's my job.
Actually, I'm pretty sure it's the job of soldiers to complete their mission. At least that was how it was back on old Earth. I was a mechanic in the Korean War, you know. Seriously, it sucks my life became about living underground and eating carrion when the summer of love was just getting started.
Richard blathered on. I think he was trying to distract me from my troubles, but he was doing a very piss-poor job of it.
John, I would like to have words with you.
Catherine's voice was as commanding as mine had earlier been. We need to discuss what you know of the necromancer and what I know. Destroying him should be the guiding focus of our efforts.
In a moment, Catherine, I'm speaking to Richard.
I raised a hand, trying to be as respectful as possible to my former lover. My squad mate's safety comes first. I wanted revenge against Ward if he was the one responsible for my squadron's death and Jessica's current condition. However, if it became a choice of her health versus Ward's death, I would choose her survival every time.
As you wish for now. Afterward, we must speak, though, Catherine said. Not a second longer, though.
So be it, I said, nodding. I am pleased you respect the bond between me and my men.
Man, I miss when people talk like normal folk, Richard sighed, shaking his head. The English language has seriously regressed since the Rising. You guys sound like you're from a different century from me.
We are from a different century than you, Mercury pointed out.
She'd already started taking notes on a chart that Richard had set aside.
Touché, Richard said. Anyone want some kidney pie? I just opened up some poor sucker and the organs are especially fresh.
Mercury opened her mouth in mute horror.
Huh, Richard said. Old ghoul joke.